Hillary, you've been my secretary for the last 20 years. Could you testify that I was always thinking rationally?
There's no question about that.
Julie, you, of all people, know me well. I engaged you to look after me, and you have become my friend. Have you ever heard me say anything irresponsible? Think.
No, Mr. Ingram.
If you had to swear to it...
I don't think that question would ever be asked.
Answer me.
Yes, Mr. Ingram. I would swear to it.
Mr. Duprex, you have just listened to the people who have known me best. Now your testimony is of the greatest importance. What's your impression of me?
I have no doubt that you're able to think as clearly as anyone in this room.
None of us have ever doubted your mental health, Mr. Ingram.
I'm glad you all agree with me.
This is Bristol. It's World War III, week 11, although there's a little bit of a hiatus since Donald Trump has gone to visit China, and they're running out of Patriot missiles. But anyway, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 15th of May 2026, streaming live from the Coomber Centre, close by Bristol City Centre. Don't believe a word we say, but we do try to share some moments of clarity from this Templar port turned merchant venturer fiefdom. And the Merchant Ventures has just finally this week cleared the very last of those nasty, dirty travellers off of the Downs. You know, the ones they evicted, Bristol City Council evicted 2 years ago. And so they had nowhere to go. But then they seem to have forgotten that in all the coverage. But anyway, they're now having to look for find somewhere to live, because that's what the council does with people. Who they're, rather than house them, they would rather arrest them and criminalise them. So that's this how the Bristol City Corporate Council Merchant Venture of Fiefdom works these days. And we're in the City of London's UK Empire of Lies, Bristol's only national news show. Well, sort of finally, the penny dropped a few weeks ago. That's what we are, is coming to you live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and holylandradio.com. 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin. And also live, of course, on the glorious... And it really is quite good, actually. I don't often try and sell anything, but it is rather nice. It's the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. Easiest place to get that is just thisweek.org.uk. This show's repeated at 11 PM on Fridays and 11 and 5 AM and PM all week on the Talk Radio stream if you miss it, except 5 PM Monday to Thursday when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. This week we've got Joe Banks in the studio talking about Bristol's new head of planning, and that is in the context of various interviews we've done with Joe. But I mean, basically, Joe is one of the only people who's documenting this descent from a democratic planning system to a corporate planning system where these big companies just build whatever they want. We'll also be hearing from Ben Trowell, who's just got back from the Palestine flotilla, the latest one that the Israelis have raided and arrested in international waters, illegally apparently, and hopefully in the final hour we'll be hearing from the former Labour MP Chris Williamson about what the programme of this new Labour Party really should be. And as someone that knows these people pretty well, this guy, Andy Burnham, is he any good? Will he be any good? I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero trust agenda psyops. In the meantime, we'll also be hearing from Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So a bit disappointing to hear from Martin that he's off to choir practice next week. We'd much rather hear from Martin, because he's actually quite good at discussing all these things. But Martin, first of all, as a current Labour Party member, what do you make of what's been going on over the last week with Keir Starmer employing Gordon Brown, bringing back these recycled Harriet Harman types, and hoping that's going to help him through? We were literally just talking about the local election results this time last week, which were looking extremely bad. He did a speech on Monday which was supposed to help him, Starmer, and it now seems that he's for the chop. But he's probably the most reluctant Prime Minister to leave that we've ever had. He's still clinging on for grim death, even though he's so unpopular. He's saying, I'm still going to fight Streeting. I'll fight Burnham. What's going on?
Well, they all cling on. I mean, very rarely.
No, they don't. That's just not true.
She did.
They don't all cling on. I mean, but if you go back, Harold Wilson.
Harold Wilson was forced out by MI5.
Well, he clung, and he wasn't actually forced, was he?
He was.
He wasn't forced.
Yes, because he was
bugged and burgled. But we have had in the past reasonably honourable prime ministers who, once they realise their numbers up, they go, right, okay, I'm out the way. And I mean, even Tony Blair did that without being forced. You know, so why is it Starmer thinks he's just going to cling on for grim death, no matter what happens, and still try and bluster it out? He still thinks he's a winner if he really thinks. That's what he's been told to say in his scripts he's reading.
Well, he's deluded in that case, isn't he? As many other politicians are. I'm thinking of one on the other side of the Atlantic.
Is your ability to be deluded, that is one of the most important key things to propel you into office, is it?
Well, you've got to have a certain personality type to want to do this stuff, haven't you? And it's certainly, you know, the people who want to be in these roles have to have a certain person. They have to be pretty thick-skinned, for example. Yeah, if you want to go into politics, you can't take offence when people have a go at you, although some do. You can't really afford that. He is basically going to try and cling on. I think what is actually happening is, behind the scenes, Wes Streeting, Andy Burnham and Angela Rayner are talking to each other through intermediaries. And I think what's been agreed, really, is that Starmer will stay on until after the by-election in Manchester, which obviously the Labour Party hopes Burnham will win, and then the possibility of triggering a formal leadership campaign will take place.
So old Farage is going to fight that one, isn't he? He reckons he can win.
Yes, it's going to be for Burnham to win in that constituency. What he may well have to do, and he's already started doing it, is talking to the Greens and the Lib Dems and saying, if you stand down in this constituency so that I get a fair run at Farage, or whoever Farage chooses, then when I'm Prime Minister, we're going to change the electoral system. Now, that is big news.
Well, that is interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
That's very big news.
Think,
if he does
do you
go
think
down that road.
Keir Starmer's friends in the City of London might be helping, shoveling a few Bob Farage's way to help him?
Farage has got massive amounts of money from crypto billionaires and all the rest of it. The Reform Party and Farage are massively funded. The Labour Party, even now, gets most of its funds from my subs and from the subs I used to pay as a trade union member. And how can you compete with foreign millionaires and billionaires just chucking money at Reform? That's what they want, because the Reform economic agenda is Thatcherism on steroids. Which is what, and if anybody thinks that's going to rescue the British economy, they're deluded. But lots of people are deluded.
So who's going to win out of this lot? If assuming Burnham does manage to get in.
Well, if Burnham manages, this is all very speculative, obviously. If he manages to win the by-election, then he becomes an MP. Then there will be a formal trigger of... Starmer will be able to stand. The question is who will be against him, because the Labour MPs will then have to go through a series of ballots to choose whoever it is who's going to be put to the membership, unless Starmer himself decides that he's going to stand down completely, and then we get a choice between two alternative candidates, not Starmer. But under the existing rules, Starmer could always say, I am going to stand and you can have one more person against me. But we'll have to see how that plays out, because Starmer's position may have become so untenable by that stage and everybody's telling him to go that he may just say, right, I'll stand aside and we can have a competition to see who's going to be my successor.
So what we had this week was a rather damp squib of a speech on Monday where Starmer thought, I won't bore you with it. Maybe I'll put it up on for anyone that wants to either torture themselves, or any somnambulists out there having trouble sleeping. You might want to have a listen to Starmer's speech on Monday. Very unexciting, almost like it was written by AI, Martin.
Well, I mean, Starmer's, you know, unique selling proposition in the first place, that he was boring a safe pair of hands, and he wasn't going to frighten the horses. So he's not really going to be able to pull out an Abraham Lincoln Gettysburg address at this stage of the game.
Well, no one is actually available to write it for him anyway, Joe.
Well, yeah, it does seem that it's what's forcing Starmer out is this visceral loathing, basically, the British public have towards him. You know, which, as you say, is partly because it's this. Whenever he's impossible to listen to, whenever he speaks, it sounds like he's reading an auto cue in the back of his head. And that's as far as I can see, this is all tied up with the fact that he also epitomises what so many people in the country have come to hate, which is London-centric. Kind of HR manager, and it's this, I think what's going to carry Burnham through is the, you know, although some, you know, some of this is maybe a bit of a performance, you know, his King of the North thing. I mean, he's a guy who actually went through quite a conventional, you know, Oxbridge spad route into politics, but he has the benefit of not sounding and looking of coming from London, basically. Well, look, and the country hates London.
One of the main things surely is this is tied in this camp of McSweeney, Mandelson, Blair, and the Tony Blair Institute, and all the money that's come with that over there.
I don't think in the country at large, that's something that, you know, plays on people's minds so much. It's more just that instinctive sense of him, you know, as a bossy London, professional managerial person.
Martin, it seems to me a lot of Starmer's demise comes from his links to Mandelson, and the fall of Mandelson has also meant the fall of the power structure that's kept him there. And one of the best comments I've seen about this is saying, well, people have got it wrong that Starmer brought Mandelson into government. No, it was the other way around. Mandelson put Starmer where he is.
Yes, I mean, I think this is the moment of truth for that faction of the Labour Party, which capture the new Labour project and everything that it represents.
This goes right back to the 1990s, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And of course it goes back further than that, because when the SDP split from the Labour Party in the 80s, that was also another of these issues. I think they've spectacular. I mean, obviously promoting Mandelson to be the ambassador of the US was an absolutely spectacularly poor decision. But in fact, you know, looking at him objectively, he's actually quite a poor player. He just makes poor decisions. So, for example, the decision not to pay the pension as the pension payment and then be forced to do it.
Yeah? Well, maybe there's a simple forced to do it.
That just shows that you don't know what you're doing.
A simple explanation for this is that he's not actually making the decisions. He's the fall guy for other people's decisions.
That's right. So, in other words, the whole Rachel Reeves Starmer project is to not frighten the horses, get money in from Palantir and the City of London. You see, what this was, the whole Blairite project was to make the funding basis for the Labour Party not the trade unions anymore. People like Trevor Chin, people, you know, so in other words, they get loads of money, Sainsbury, they get loads of money from these business people. They will only give money to the Labour Party if it is pro-business. So that's a very strong constraint on the thinking of that faction.
I mean, we've also had market wobbles this week, which has been quite interesting to see, as Starmer looks like he's not going to go. So the bond markets start to complain. And I thought it was wonderful that Diane Abbott was chipping in saying, what's the point of us being MPs if actually we're at the behest of the bond markets?
Well, that is a fundamental problem that we all face. Now, there are ways around that, because you don't actually have to borrow in the bond market to spend money. That's modern monetary theory.
But look what it did to Liz Truss. I mean, you know, this is the bond market's going, no.
Well, that's right. Then, this is the problem for all democratic politics all over the world.
When did that start in this country, or has it always been there?
No, it started with the Big Bang. It's always been there.
1980s, Margaret Thatcher. It's always been there. What was the Big Bang?
The Big Bang was when the City of London used to be fairly tightly regulated compared to what it is now, and Margaret Thatcher decided to lift all the regulations, which allowed loads of foreign money to come, you know, mostly US money, to come flooding into the
this
city.
This is partly getting rid of exchange controls.
That's right,
as well,
getting rid of exchange controls in 1979, all of this stuff. And, of course, the Big Bang then directly led to the first, you know, the crash of 87, I think it was. And, of course, ultimately to the 2008 crash, which is the underlying factor in everything going on the planet. The banking system simply collapsed, and then the state stepped in and made it whole again with the resources of the taxpayer. And most people have forgotten about that. So we're all talking in this very... Now, people like Zach Polanski are now talking in terms of, well, we don't necessarily have to borrow money in the bond market to spend money. And everybody's going, no, you can't say that.
But well, Farage was saying that we can actually... the Bank of England can be making money up. We don't need to borrow it from private banks. I mean, there's some interesting ideas out there.
Those ideas are sort of bubbling away. And they will come to fruition when the banks collapse, is what is going to happen. Possibly before the end of the year, the banking system will collapse again, and it'll be much more spectacular than 2008. And then, of course, all sorts of questions start to be asked.
But the banks didn't collapse in 2008.
No,
they were
bailed out. They won't be able to bail them out this time. They'll have to nationalise them all, and we'll have to change completely the way we do, the way we think about the economy.
I look forward to that anyway.
It won't be much fun, I'm telling you.
Well, maybe not, but it needs to happen, doesn't it? At some point, we need to have a realistic banking system or not. We'll be having a chat to Joe in a minute about what's going on within the planning system here in Bristol, because over the years, it's been being eroded. The individual councillors and residents of the city's input into decisions made about usually vast student accommodation, but all sorts of massive buildings being put here in the city, usually very, very high up to cram as many floors as possible and make as much money as possible. There really doesn't seem to be much in the way of pushback these days if you're in amongst the club of big developers at all in the city. But before we hear that, let's have a listen to the only bit I could find, which was, I mean, she did actually quite a good speech, I thought, Kemi Badenoch, on Wednesday, I think it was, as part of the debate on the opening of the debate on the King's Speech, which we'll be hearing a little clip from the King's Speech as well in a minute. And I mean, that is a whole nother question here. Is this is a joke of a King's Speech? No wonder the King was a bit annoyed. This is a government which is about to collapse, and they want me to sit here and read out what they're about to do. There's an element of Monty Python about this guy sitting there telling everyone what might be about to happen, but then maybe it won't. In fact, many of the King's Speech stuff is from the past. It just simply hasn't happened. So let's have a listen now to Kemi Badenoch.
Everything that has gone wrong in Labour's first 2 years comes back to one problem. They came into office with no plan. They did not understand the difference between winning an election and governing a country. It was very easy to make promises in opposition. Promises to freeze council tax, promises to take £300 off energy bills, promises to the WASPI women. Hundreds of Labour MPs took photos with them to post on their Facebook pages and their websites and their election leaflets, but at no point did they bother to think how would they deliver any of it. They didn't spend their time in opposition thinking deeply about the country's problems. They assumed that governing in the 2020s would be like governing in the 1990s. But it isn't. Britain is facing new structural problems. We have an aging... Mr. Speaker, they'll shout at me. I know they can't wait to get back to their plotting, but it's quite important that we hear what is going to be said. Because we have an ageing population, a falling birth rate, and a welfare bill that is spiralling out of control. We have an information revolution in the shape of AI that threatens to unravel the world of work as we know it, and the cost of energy is driving industry out of the country. Labour were taken by surprise that we are living in a more competitive and increasingly hostile world. Their manifesto was just a set of misleading promises. They promised no new taxes on working people. Fail. They promised to crack down on illegal immigration. Failed. They promised to tread more lightly on people's lives. Epic fail. They made promises without knowing how anything works.
So that's Kemi Badenoch there in the reply to the King's Speech debate opening by Prime Minister, just about Steel Keir Starmer. And now, Joe, she goes on after that to talk about housing as one of the problems, that they haven't actually delivered the number of homes that they're supposed to. And as part of that, there have been enormous relaxations in the planning. That's what they, at least that's been announced nationally. We're going to just let people just build as many houses as possible because we're desperate for housing. Obviously, the house builders are also rather pleased about all this because house prices are very, very high, so they can make profits. When it comes to actually putting an extension on your home, you might find quite a lot of difficulty, but I know you've been finding in Bristol, it's one of the places developers love to come if they want to build high, build tiny little apartments, little flats inside, flatlets for students, etc. So what have you been looking into?
Yes, so I've just written a piece called Who is Bristol's Chief Planner Working For? And that's on my Substack called Temple Scenes, which explores these issues in Bristol. So somewhere like Bristol, with so these major UK cities like Bristol obviously have housing crises, which makes them very attractive when you've got a massive increase in student population. So you've had in Bristol, student populations increased by about 50% over the last decade. That makes them very attractive to investors. In Bristol, there's been this process, as you mentioned, really since Marvin Rees came in as mayor in 2016 with a very clear mission to make Bristol much more attractive to developers and investors.
Yeah, he had a little phrase, cranes on the horizon.
Yeah, so this is a sign of a successful, growing city.
Yeah.
There was this sort of, there's a strange mix because on one level he could say, housing is the priority. And yet, at the same time, the sort of pretty much the central growth strategy was through the universities, which was ramping up, which is ramping up the housing crisis.
Well, in what way do universities ramp up the housing crisis, though?
Well, if you've got, you've got tens of thousands of more.
Oh, right, you're bringing in loads and loads of students.
They particularly wanted to attract foreign students. The biggest proportion, the largest proportion of that expansion has been foreign students who their fees aren't capped. And so the university can make a lot more money off them. And, this is where the partnership works with the developers and investors, is that they generally want purpose-built student accommodation. This is the new stuff.
But this seems to me to be mainly a sort of deal between the developers and the university. The city is sort of on the sidelines watching the university saying, right, we want loads more students in the city. The developers saying, yes, we'll do it. We can do it for you, while the city watches. And one of the main problems, of course, with all this student accommodation is the council's not getting any council tax at all from any of this.
Yeah. And increased pressure on services. So I've in this piece I've looked at a particular development that came to the planning committee in January this year, called Princess Street.
Just to put this in context, I think we ought to mention you did a couple of years ago quite a fascinating investigation into something which is they've now actually started to build, which is St Mary Le Port, which is right next to Bristol Bridge, which is where Bristol gets its name from, on the edge of Castle Park. And it's, as part of that, you uncovered a sort of, it was a covert campaign by the developers in favour of the developers, which was pretending to be the local people saying, we think this is great.
Well, that was a sort of astroturfing group who were involved in the community consultation. That was one aspect of it. But another central aspect to that whole story was because it was a pivotal development in this very sensitive site, the historic centre of the city, half of the old city had been destroyed in the Second World War, and there was this sort of this tussle going on between the mayor's office and the people within the council, not just the planning department, but you also had this group called City Design, you know, who were the placemakers, the people who were supposed to challenge developers and hold them to account, and in terms of policy, you know, so there were policies not clear policies on height in terms of meters or stories, but in terms of the context of the old city there.
So there's a tug of war going on there, isn't there, between the council and what the people want on the one hand, well, and the developers on the other hand.
Well, it's not, but it's within the council. I mean, because you had the mayor's office, you had them placing pressure, and you had this guy called Stephen Peacock who'd come into the council in 2019, and he's I think a significant figure in the story of what's happened in Bristol. He came from this corporate background. Basically, he'd worked for a decade with BP. He was sort of in the early days of the mobile phone revolution. He was in telecoms, and then he goes into this quango called the Southwest Regional Development Agency, which was a new Labour quango, basically, that was giving out funds from the EU to stimulate regional economic development.
And all these people, I think it's clear to see, there are conflicts going on within their minds between, are they public servants or are they there to forward corporate interests?
Yeah, it's very unclear, and there's this revolving door. But one of the people working with Stephen Peacock at that time, around sort of 2007, 2006, was this woman, Simone Wilding, who has now become Bristol's chief planner, and was appointed to that role in 2023 by Stephen Peacock and Marvin Rees, after they'd been through this period of having these tussles and then bringing in these reforms, restructuring the planning service. And part of that was the creation of this new chief planner role that Wilding came into. She came in, after the Southwest Regional Development Agency, she'd gone to the Planning Inspectorate, who were based in Bristol, and been a very senior manager. She'd been head of operations at the Planning Inspectorate. So she was already sort of embedded locally in Bristol, but was brought in as someone who was a technocrat, a capable manager who was going to oversee these reforms that Rees and Peacock had put in place, which were basically all about, you know, reducing friction for developers.
Well, the developers in the city had had a bit of a problem with the former mayor, George Ferguson, who was for a while the president of the Royal Institute of British Architects, who was pushing back against this sort of unbridled development, very high modernist style buildings, and he wanted things to be more in character, lower, and so he was trying to make sure that the planning groups, committees, officers within the council made it clear to the developers is that we actually do have a local plan here, and if you want to build things, you're going to have to fit in, otherwise you're not going to get your planning permission. But there's now a different regime, really, where the developers and the speculators have got to the point where they put in some quite audacious plans that they know don't really fit with what people like Ferguson and the rest of the city want. And then they say, well, if you don't accept it, we'll just appeal it. And there's a threat with it that if we don't get this, it's going to cost you a lot of money. Mm. So anyway, go on.
Well, that is what was specifically used. So Wilding has become very sort of forceful at planning committees in, you know, pushing councillors to approve in line with officer recommendations.
And ideally, they're not supposed to get involved in this at all, are they? The political people, like Marvin when he was the mayor. He's supposed to keep his hands away from this.
The executive is supposed to be totally separate, from the sort of statutory planning
interfering? How did they interfere?
Well, I mean, this is what I explored in the Samaria Port story. I mean, you can see you know, they're off the record, and you know, looking at freedom of information requests and looking at emails. You know, there were meetings going on between the developers and the head of the mayor's office, and Stephen Peacock as a senior officer. And you can see minutes from meetings where, you know, they're saying you had the head of development management at the time saying we need to he's trying to hold the line on the height of these buildings. And there's a different argument coming back, saying, you know, so this needs to be
right.
We need to make the argument about economic development.
So when the speculators and the developers they're not getting their way, it looks like they might not get their way. They just pick up the phone, have a little chat with the mayor's office, and then they can then put pressure, but they're not supposed to be able to put pressure on. Anyway, look, George, should we go back to this development you're talking about, Princess Street?
Yeah. So this is this.
January it was, yeah.
January it came to the committee for the first time, and this was going to be, this would be the tallest ever building in South Bristol. So it's a mixed-use development, including 434 student accommodation units, 400 build-to-rent flats, and some commercial floor space. And the student tower is 23 storeys. And this is within a context of base, you know, low-rise residential terraces.
What, two, three stories, four, five stories around there?
Yeah, five, the very max.
Okay,
yeah.
So 23.
So 23.
They're like and the this Tower is of Babel. It's like this is what they seem to want, up and up and up, more money.
But this, I mean, the thing is, what one of the things Rees did was introduce a planning document called Urban Living, and this was going to replace a 2005 document that had, you know, put height limits on buildings in the centre of Bristol. And what Urban Living did was say it's all about context. So you can have tall buildings, but they need to, work, not dominate the local context.
Yeah, it's quite difficult for a tall building not to dominate, really. But also, to be fair, Joe, back in the 1950s and 1960s, there were tower blocks being built around the city, which were way, way higher than the terraced houses that were underneath them.
Yeah, but we're getting that now.
Yeah,
again, but this is not social housing. This is, so the rationale from the developers of why they need to build a 23-story. PBSA block,
purpose-built student accommodation,
is that's the only way that they could afford to offer, 20% affordable housing.
So the developers were knocked back. They were told, no, this is too big.
So it didn't. Yeah, it didn't go. So the councillors refused it that first meeting. And what happens at Bristol City Council is, if the planning committee refuses, it's then up to the officers to go away and write up those reasons for refusal. They come back to a following meeting, and then that is voted through.
When you say it's voted through, you mean the reason for the decision is voted through after the committee decision not to accept an application?
Well, that first one doesn't count, even though they voted on it. That doesn't count as an actual decision.
Oh, really?
They call it a deferral, and then so they have to come back, and then and then there are all kinds of manoeuvres and communications between the developers and the planning department, and as came out with the big Broadwalk development a couple of years ago, there was lots going on between the councillors, between certain councillors who are in favour of the development and the developers, and they're working out a strategy of how to get it through the second meeting.
This is a fantastic amount of money involved in these, and profit, of course.
But what ended up then the committee at the second meeting reversing their original decision were these threats from the chief planner of massive appeal costs, basically saying that the developers are going to take this, are going to appeal against the decision, will lose. And the chief planner came up with a figure of £750,000 plus £250,000 legal costs. So she was saying it was going to cost the council £1 million to turn down this planning application, despite the fact that I haven't been able to find any record of any council having to pay up anything near £750,000 at appeal. It's very rare that the planning inspectorate make large appeal costs at all, and it's really hard to find any that are beyond, you know, at most £200,000.
But she was from the planning inspectorate.
Yeah.
So she's like a gamekeeper turned poacher.
I suppose so. Yeah.
She's a regulator, basically, that's now in the situation. I mean, also this role, the whole role of a chief planner is, I mean, from my memory, it used to be just planning officer. A planning officer would be assigned to a specific development and would guide it through and recommend as to whether it fitted in with the law.
Well, previously you had a head of development management at Bristol, but this is part of these reforms that Rees and Peacock brought in to create that chief planner role, was having someone with more power, overarching kind of authority.
Someone they could bring in to get the really big controversial developments through, maybe.
Yes, yes, yeah. What I've done in this piece, as a sort of this sort of interesting window into how she sees the role and approaches it.
No, I know you've been looking through LinkedIn, haven't you?
LinkedIn,
lots and lots of. This is a sort of, I suppose it's a professional Facebook, you could call it.
Yeah.
But you can see her interactions with. I mean, you would have thought that if she's being influenced and being rather too chummy and pally with the land speculators, that she would try and keep away from that. She's supposed to. She's a publicly paid person.
I was shocked. That's why I've written about it. I was shocked. I mean, I knew all this background, and I knew I could see why they'd chosen her and put her into this role. But I was shocked at how flagrant all these interactions were for someone, you know, who you would expect working for the local state as a chief planner. Obviously, they've got to have a relationship with the development community, but this is on this sort of. Really chatty, friendly level with lot, and you can see these dinners and awards, and even parties that developers are throwing, and she's going along to them.
They're not inviting me to these parties.
Yeah, you know the wrong people, Tony.
Maybe we should gate crash them.
And you know, this is while she's deliberating on planning applications that these people, you know, have submitted to the council. But it's this break. It's a bit. What it illustrates is this breakdown, you know, of these walls, and that Bristol's chief planner is basically another part of the development ecosystem. A partner, an ally. A friend, even, of these development professionals.
You know? Now, doesn't she chit-chat in a similar sort of way with councillors, with people who are campaigners, like Matthew Montague Pollock, who's in the campaign against tower blocks?
I didn't find that. I didn't see that. And I've seen no evidence that she's... going to local planning groups and chatting with them on Facebook.
Yeah, because
like
there are quite a few.
There's
actually.
Quite a lot in Bristol,
and things like the Civic Society put a little bit of pressure on occasionally. Surely this is the job of the lobbyists. What I'm coming around to saying, Joe, is the lobbyists, and there is a vast amount of money in sloshing around in these developers' pockets. And so they obviously have their own lobbyists that go in, and they are wooing her. I mean, that's part of their job.
I mean, these are quite a lot of these interactions are literally with lobbyists, whose job it is, to get planning consent for their very wealthy customers.
And so she steps into these planning committee meetings, does she? And steps up, and she's telling the councillors. Really, this is what the planning officers are supposed to do. They're supposed to give impartial advice on what the law is to do with local planning to the councillors. Which, so if they're a bit saying, well, hang on, they're trying to do this, they're trying to do 23 stories, is that okay in that area? And so the a planning officer will say, actually, our local plan says no, it's only five stories. That sort of thing. That's what the planning officers are there for. Yeah. So she is actually turning up at these meetings.
And it's the... I mean, well, she's meant to be in... you can see why she would be in the meetings to, yeah, as you say, offer that advice on policy.
Helping the councillors round the local plan.
Yeah. But it's... I mean, it's clear that, you know... She sees her role there... you know, as convincing and using all kinds of, you know, all kinds of sleights of hand as well. I mean, she, in that first meeting for Princess Street, she made the false claim to them that she was making a big thing of talking about a development in Brighton called Brighton Gasworks, and she was trying to illustrate the fact that the planning inspectorate are very willing to overturn decisions that are made on the basis of over-densification, which is basically what was happening here, you know, over-densification of the site. And she said, well, she was citing this development in Brighton and saying this one was even more dense than the one we're looking at here in Bristol, which was just not true. There are measurements which were actually in the Bristol Officer report for dwellings per hectare is the measurement DPH, and the Brighton one was around 250. The Bristol one, when you include the student accommodation, was near 450. The density and in London planning debates. There was this concept of hyperdensity that was developed about 10 years ago, and that sits at 350 dwellings per hectare. So once you're above that, you're into hyperdensity. And this is, you know, these are way above that. But she said to the committee, we don't have a policy on density to refuse this.
Do they?
There are lots of, you know, there isn't necessarily one specific policy, but there are all kinds of policies related to density and, you know, super density and hyper density, because of the, you know, the pressure that they put on services. So, you know, the NHS wrote a statement for this planning application, objecting to the development because they said we don't have the local. You know, infrastructure in place to support a development at this scale.
So there are reasons not to. Maybe that's why she's been invited to these award ceremonies by the developers.
Yeah. So she's going. She's actually next month. She's going to be at a national one, the Planning Awards at Savoy Place in London. This is in the piece, but you look at the marketing. For the, they're selling tickets for the event, and the first thing that they, the first reason they give for why you should put in these tickets, I think they're about £300 to go, but the first thing is to get to network with our guests, including our judges.
It's amazing that with someone who's supposed to be in the council at the moment as a regulator, was in the past as a regulator, now is one of the chief facilitators of these massive developments. That you also talk about something called the shadow system.
Well, yeah, what's going on LinkedIn, it seems to me, is another example of this, of the shadow planning system. You know, it's these spaces that exist outside, you know, formal democratic planning structures. And you could see that with the Samaria Laporte investigation. You could see, you know, that's going on with off-the-record meetings happening. And it's supposed to, you know, if you read the National Planning Policy Framework, which is supposed to guide, you know, the sort of statutory framework that's supposed to guide development in this country. You know, the planning system is supposed to be fair and transparent, but there are all these shadow elements to it, and this seems to be, you know, another one of them, where there's this communication and signalling going on that you don't, no one's going to see unless, like me, you're nosy and you go and have a look
at it. Yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's, you could almost draw, couldn't you, a little Venn diagram of how it's all supposed to work with the planners, the planning committee, the council officers, the regulators, and that's how it's supposed to work. But what we're seeing by looking at your article on the LinkedIn, there's a totally different way that it actually really works with some of the key people who are supposed to be safeguarding the public interest in bed with the speculators who are just there to make money.
Yeah. And this is a wider, you know, you can pull the camera back a bit just from Bristol. And this does tie in with the broader strategy of this Labour government, who, you know, even before they came into power, were making deregulating the planning system one of their key drivers for growth, as they see it. But as you said, and they had this 1.5 million housing target with that nasty piece of work, Steve Reed, the Secretary of State for Housing, who was going around the Labour conference last year with his MAGA, red MAGA cap that said "Build, Baby, Build" on it. And we're sort of tapping into the energies of the YIMBY movement, which is this sort of centrist, centre-right, group who believe that the issue is just a supply issue, and you can just put it in the hands of the developers, and that's going to sort out the problem. But obviously the housing crisis is a lot more complex than that.
Well, you mentioned social housing. Absolutely right. But why is social housing not happening? I mean, surely local authorities could, if they wanted to, go to the bond markets, borrow money, build council housing. There's nothing to stop them, is there?
I don't think local authorities can do that.
One of the things that might stop them is that when they do that, they've got to then have the right to, the people have got to have the right to buy. So they might not be able to keep that.
Well, one thing, to be fair, one thing actually in this coming out of this, the government's new policy programme from the King's Speech was something on right to buy, where they're going to extend it to 10 years before you can have the right to buy. I don't know how much of an impact that will make. I mean, currently in Bristol, that there's more right to buy happening than council houses being built still. They are making some attempts to make it harder for council housing to be sold off.
Okay,
the council housing waiting list in Bristol is around 20,000 households.
Okay, so is it legal for public servants like our dear friend Simone Wilding, Bristol's chief planner, to be in bed with these developers and to be facilitating and also to be telling untruths to planning committee councillors?
I find it hard to gauge, you know, where the legal parameters are. There's guidance from, you have the Royal, I think it's the Royal Town Planning Institute, which is the main sort of professional body, which has these clear guidelines, you know, and they're all about not having bias or predetermination. That you're there to be in sort of, you know, you're there, you're an independent arbiter who's balancing arguments and making trade-offs, but it's It's a good question. That's a good question.
Well, it is. I mean, standards in public life seem to have been sliding. We even had the King's Speech with Charlie saying this week, oh, we will bring in legislation to make higher standards in public life, blah, blah, blah. But this is all just talk. Seems to me it's all sliding down to maybe Martin. I mean, this is a corporate agenda, isn't it, that's just being rolled out. These people want to make money. They want to expand the university, bring more students in. And the council and the local population have just been sidelined here.
Well, it's a creeping process, isn't it? I mean, if you think back to the immediate post-war period, local authorities really did have planning powers. You know, they could build council houses right next to private estates. They control the transport, and we've come a long way from that. This is all the fruits of the deregulatory 1980s, and now we've finally arrived where, in actual fact, local people have very little influence over what goes on, and it's all decided in the way that we've just heard.
So what should happen, Joe? Have you been going through all this? Have you seen any sort of inkling that there's anybody that's aware of what's going on and able to maybe roll things back to make the planning system serve the city rather than a few outsiders with money?
Well, in Bristol, you did have quite an extraordinary thing that happened. I mentioned earlier the Broadwalk development, which was in a suburb of South Bristol in Knowle, which was going to be a hyper dense development, and you had an amazing local campaign led by two or three, you know, very dynamic women who were able to make the developers, and they had to do it on their own because the local authority, it was a total stitch up, you know. And this was another example where you had a planning application being refused, then they bring it back to the second committee meeting, and there's all the shenanigans, and then they get it through the second one.
So just to sort of finish with the initial planning in Princess Street, that was obviously came back and was accepted. Am I right?
It was Princess the second Street, one. It was voted through, okay, because of that threat of costs.
Yeah, okay.
You had two councillors, and I mean that's another thing with that is that you're only in law you can only have your reasons for approving something or refusing it has to be in line with the development plan or what they call material considerations. Appeal costs is neither of those. So in law, you can't actually use
that.
So
not only is she talking rubbish about Brighton, she's also talking nonsense by even introducing the threat of
a fine. Well, it's a very odd thing. She can bring it up as something to consider, but councillors aren't allowed to actually use that as a reason.
Right.
You know, for approval, which they did in the meeting. they explicitly said, two of them, I'm going to approve this because we can't risk these appeal costs. But sorry, just to go back to I bring up the Broadwalk thing because it was this local campaign and the threat of a judicial review, because basically you've got to threaten these people with losing money or, you know. Major legal consequences. So they had the threat of a judicial review they were likely to win. But it forced the developers to come back with a new scheme, which has now actually gone through. So that was an example. That was an example of a kind of local resistance.
Brilliant. Well, what was the difference between?
There is now a fundraiser for the Princess Street one, and they've already raised £10,000.
Right.
They've got a campaign building there.
Fantastic. Well, look, what was can I just ask you, in the Broadwalk thing in South Bristol, what was the difference in the, what did they manage to,
they,
how did they manage to change the application?
They reduced the height they had, because they were going to have these massive towers overlooking the park there, and they moved them to, well, they scaled that down and moved the higher bits towards a main road, and they had some housing, that could be for families, because that's the thing. All these developments come forward; it's all student stuff or what they're calling co-living, which is basically student accommodation but for graduates, or it's these build-to-rent, you know, luxury flats. And this is why there's so much, I think, you know, a big reason why there's local anger, is that it's not, you know, it's not for families, and it's not for a range of people, and it doesn't build communities. It's gated. They're gated communities, basically.
So it's a bit of a game, actually, that the speculators are playing. I remember when we were discussing, I think it was tail end of last year, looking at this new development in the Bear Pit with the Israeli firm that's funding the massive student, the biggest, tallest student is accommodation in the city. So they're thinking,
just the tallest building. That's going to be the tallest building ever in the city.
But they're saying things like, I tell you what, now we've got our planning application, let's just make it more dense and let's get rid of the balconies. And
yeah, so that's another trick they often play. Yeah,
so this is after they've got their planning permission, they then say, oh, we changed our mind, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that. I mean, we had the same thing, didn't we, with the I think it was the General Hospital when that was sold off. That was turned into mostly luxury flats. And it was supposed to be something like 20%, if I remember rightly, for social housing. And then when they started building it, they said, well, actually, we're not going to do any social housing. Forget it.
Mm. Well, I mean, this is another development that's happened, because it's all this developer-led model all just, you know, results in basically begging them for little scraps of affordable housing. Well, in quotes, affordable, often just discounted market rate, which is obviously already very high in somewhere like Bristol. But there's now a big move by the developers to claim viability issues because of the cost of construction, because of land values, because of interest rates. So there are more and more. There's more and more falling back on those affordable commitments. So actually, the council recently introduced a kind of addendum to their affordable housing policy, where now developers who've already got consented schemes can come back and negotiate down their affordable housing commitments.
Well, they shouldn't be able to do that. They've got the planning permission to do something. They should just carry on and do it. How can they just say, well, I tell you what, we're not going to do what we agreed to do?
That's how it works. And they say that we're not going to build it. We're not going to build it, you know, otherwise.
Well, I also noticed you did expose the funding being from this Israeli company. Is it?
Well, So the way they do all these developments is a developer. So that one, it's Olympian as the developer.
We're talking now about the Bear Pit.
The Bear Pit. Yeah. They'll get the thing designed, you know, employ the architects. They'll buy the land first, get it designed and get it through planning, and then they sell it off to investors. And the investors for this one are two companies, one Kane International, who are a massive, you know, global luxury real estate company, whose CEO is Jonathan Goldstein, who was very active in the Corbyn anti-Semitism smear, and an Israeli asset management firm called Menorah Mivtajim. And they're working together. They're doing the funding for actually quite a lot of purpose-built student accommodation all across the UK.
Well, it's advertised around the world, this, as in Britain. If you do this, it's one of the best returns in the world. You put your money
safe,
into this accommodation.
Secure, long-term yields.
Yep. And all these students are getting either lots of money from abroad, or else they're getting grants here, loans actually. And so you're guaranteed to get your money.
Yeah,
apparently.
Yeah. So it's quite. I mean, so they're doing. You know, Kane International are building these insane developments. You know, in Los Angeles and places for the ultra rich, or in the Gulf states. You know, in Saudi Arabia and places. Yeah, and they're also building student accommodation in Bristol.
Well, they're also building what we call Tin City. If you go up to Chittern on Salisbury Plain, where the army train, there's a place called Tin City there, which is, well, it's nicknamed Tin City, where the army train for urban warfare, that Minora Mitchavim were involved in building a similar place for the Israeli army in the Negev Desert, I think.
Yeah.
This is to train to fight in Gaza.
And their shareholders in, I think it's GS1, who do a lot of the sort of surveillance infrastructure, security infrastructure in Israeli prisons and checkpoints. Yeah.
Well, we're going to be hearing a bit more about Israeli prisons and Israeli checkpoints. But before we introduce Ben Trowell, our next guest, thanks very much for that, Joe, and I hope you'll stay with us to talk about this a little bit. We have, and you mentioned anti-Semitism there. Last weekend there was what they call anti-Semitism rally in London, in the city centre.
Attacks against Jewish communities are spreading fear. Also in North London, Jewish ambulances torched. In Manchester, last October, two men murdered at a synagogue.
For many people who've attended today's rally, their motivation for being here is anger and sadness and fear that Britain, which had once given safe haven to Jews and welcomed them after the Second World War, somehow to many Jews now doesn't feel safe. Why was it important for you to come today?
Because I fear for my family. And I want to show solidarity with Jewish people. I'm very proud to be Jewish.
What's changed?
I think what's changed is a government that isn't facing up to the fact that these horrors are going on and doing something about it.
And do you mean this government in particular, or do you mean a trend?
I think it's a trend. I think this government hasn't done enough to recognise the enormity of the challenge that the Jewish community faces.
The King has met the victims of last month's stabbings in Golders Green in a demonstration of royal support for the Jewish community. The King also spoke to the chief rabbi, who said the community enormously appreciated his visit to the neighbourhood. From Golders Green, our special correspondent Lucy Manning sent this report.
Hundreds of people lined the streets and stood on balconies and rooftops to see the King. He passed only metres from where the two Jewish men were stabbed a fortnight ago. He met the victims, Moshe Shine and Shloimi Rand. Mr. Shine said the King didn't let go of his hand and his visit felt extremely important for the Jewish community. The King met the crowds which had gathered in huge numbers. Most thanked him for showing solidarity with a community that's faced increasing anti-Semitism, arson and physical attacks. Some said a special Jewish blessing recited on seeing a monarch. The chief rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, said the visit was enormously appreciated.
What an amazing day, but what a sad day. It's so incredible that the King has made this gesture, and so very sad that the reason for his coming is because of a terrorist action.
The Jewish volunteer security group Shomrim, which responded to the Golders Green stabbing, also met the King. Gary Ost is from the organisation.
He took a lot of interest into the work that Shom does. Claimed that it was courageous work. He asked us about training and he raised his concerns that he has regarding the rise in anti-Semitism.
The Jewish community in Golders Green has in recent weeks faced a stabbing attack and an arson attack on charity ambulances. Many have felt the wider British community hasn't stood fully alongside it, which is why the King's visit here was seen as so important.
Prince Harry has also commented today on what he called the deeply troubling rise of anti-Semitism in the UK. Writing in the New Statesman, the Duke of Sussex said that while it was legitimate and necessary to criticise states which act without accountability, without naming any specific country, he stated that nothing could justify hostility towards an entire people or faith. He also called for people to confront both anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim hate. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered a defamation lawsuit to be filed against the New York Times newspaper after it claimed that widespread sexual violence was being committed against Palestinian prisoners by Israeli security forces and settlers. The article includes testimony from 14 Palestinians who allege they were subjected to sexual assault and rape. Israel's foreign ministry has accused the paper of hideous and distorted lies.
So, Martin, what do you make of the anti-Semitism march, and also the King is... In the King's speech, he's talking about anti-Semitism being a problem. He didn't mention Islamophobia at all.
No, I mean, obviously, this thing has been cooked up as a result of the incident, the stabbing incident that happened quite recently. But, of course, that's being presented in a very distorted light. This guy's clearly got mental health issues. He previously stabbed police officers. He stabbed one of his mates from 20 years before, who's a Muslim. And then he ends up... It's not even clear that he knew the people he was stabbing were Jewish. He was in Golders Green, so he's probably a good guess.
He was actually just outside Golders Green.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, it's not at all clear that this is in any way a terrorist incident. It's a very regrettable incident, obviously. Who wants stuff like that happening? But I also noticed that Mervis there, who's the head of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, and he's being given a kind of, you know, he's really pleased that the King's there and all the rest of it. He is a very strong supporter of the Israeli Defence Forces. He said they're doing a great job in Gaza, and his own son is serving in the Defence Forces in Gaza.
Well, last weekend...
Now, I'm not saying that justifies stabbing people, but on the other hand, he is a supporter of terrorism.
Last weekend, Ephraim Mervis called for the expulsion of the Iranian ambassador.
Who has?
Mervis, at this
rally. Oh, in other words, what has the Iranians got to do with this? This is what's very suspicious about
all of this.
Apparently
it's an Iranian online group of some sort that's carried it out.
Yes, I know, I've forgotten the name of it, but it's quite clear that this group is a front organisation for the Israeli intelligence services. There's not a shred of evidence to suggest that the Iranians would be involved in any of these attacks. The main attacks at Bondi Beach and the one in Manchester, which were carried out by Sunni Muslims. Sunni Muslims, and the extremist Sunni Muslims in particular, hate the Iranians. They want to kill them. So there's absolutely no reason why the Iranians would be behind these attacks. But what I consider to be much more likely is this is a deliberate campaign by the Israeli intelligence services of attacks on Jewish communities, deliberate attacks on Jewish communities, which can then be blamed on the Iranians. And if the police arrested two people for the burning of the ambulances, and then they haven't told us what nationality they are or what race they are. And in actual fact, they've been released on bail. Now, if you look into this properly, it may well turn out that these people are actually working directly or indirectly for the Israeli intelligence services. Now, would the Israeli intelligence services attack Jewish community structures? And the answer to that is very definitely yes.
Is there any track record of this?
Yes, there is. In Iraq in the 1950s, they bombed several synagogues.
Half a century ago.
All right, well, they bombed...
Three quarters of a century ago.
Okay, but they bombed deliberately, the Israeli Air Force deliberately bombed the only synagogue in Tehran. And it was a deliberate targeting. They didn't kill anybody, but they wrecked the place.
That's a bit more recently.
Well, that's very recently. It was a couple of weeks ago. Now, that is a deliberate targeting by the Israeli Air Force because they don't like Jewish people living in Iran. There's a long-established Jewish community in Iran. They've lived there for hundreds of years, and they're well accepted. They have two guaranteed seats in the Iranian parliament, which are just for Jews. And of course, if you go to Saudi Arabia, who are our allies, well, British military is embedded with the Saudi military, there are no synagogues, because every kind of religion other than Sunni Muslim Wahhabism is forbidden in Saudi Arabia. And all the women have to wear full burqa.
Maybe we should go to war with them. In 1994, a car bomb exploded outside the Israeli embassy in Kensington, London. That was in July the 26th. Annie Machon, former MI5 intelligence officer, has alleged that bombing was a false flag operation carried out by the Israeli intelligence agency Mossad to discredit Palestinian activists and increase security for Israeli interests.
Yes, and two Palestinian activists were then convicted for the bombing, and they are still in prison all these years later, even though they're entirely innocent. Now, that's a bombing. And, of course, the bombing was then used as an excuse to invade Lebanon. I think that's the same incident. Now, in other words, we're not allowed to say this. It's anti-Semitic to accuse the Israeli intelligence services of any kind of bad behaviour. But they've got a record as long as your arm going back decades. They write books about Rise Up and Kill First, where they boast about the assassinations they've carried out. Yeah, but look at the pager attacks in Lebanon. By any definition, that is a terrorist act. But at the same time, we're not allowed to say so because it's anti-Semitic. I think it's just stupid and ridiculous. And of course, who bombs synagogues? The Israeli Air Force. Does that make the Israeli Air Force anti-Semitic? I would say definitely yes, it does.
So the United Nations says conspiracy theorist, former MI5 officer Annie Machon, will not appear on a panel at the world body. They've got her removed from this event program, the B'nai B'rith have, because she said that she believed that the Israeli government was involved in the 9/11 attacks as well.
Let's look at it this way. Five Israelis were...
She sounds a bit dodgy, don't you think?
Well, we've known her for years, Tony, as you know. She's not at all dodgy. She's very intelligent, and she knows what she's talking about because she was an MI5 insider. As Trump himself said on 9/11, buildings like that don't collapse just like that. Something's going on here. He was right. There were three buildings that went down, not two, three. And anyway, only two planes.
Let's bring things a little bit more up to date. We're joined by Ben Trower. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Tony.
And you, I should be asking you if you're all right. Can you just tell us what's been going on with you in the last few weeks?
Yeah, sure. So I joined the flotilla in Barcelona, the Global Simud Flotilla, and was illegally kidnapped by Israel.
So how many boats were on the flotilla? And also, why did you decide to go to Barcelona to hop on a boat to head to Gaza?
So it's a non-violent humanitarian mission to break Israel's illegal siege on Gaza. I joined in Barcelona, which is the first port, because that's where they needed people to join.
So what is it that about the issue in Gaza that makes you think this sort of thing's so important to do? You've obviously given up your time for this, and no one's paying you to do it, are they?
I've definitely not been paid to do it. No. In fact, I'm breaking the bank right now trying to find some work because scraping things back together after being illegally kidnapped.
Take us through the trip, from Barcelona onwards. What was the boat you were on, or ship like, and what was on it?
So the boat I was on, I was on two boats. The original boat I was on did break down and we had to get towed by Open Arms, but I then got reassigned a different boat. We were literally carrying humanitarian aid. We had like rice and things like that on our boat. It was all just food. Other boats had medicines, just delivering life-saving essential aid to the people of Palestine.
So basically, it's quite a long way, isn't it, from Spain all the way down to Gaza?
It is, yeah. So there were stops all along the way, pre-planned stops to build the fleet. So by the end of it, we were going to have over 70 vessels, which we then would have all congregated in Turkey and sailed Turkey direct to Gaza.
So where did you stop on the way?
So we stopped, we were meant to stop in Sicily, but my boat didn't quite make it there. So we got towed into a different port and then I taxied across Sicily. And then from Sicily, we were due to arrive in, or we weren't going to dock in Crete because the Greek authorities wouldn't allow us, but we were going to, anchor up and wait for some more comrades to join us. But we actually got intercepted over 600 nautical miles from occupied Palestine. So way out of their jurisdiction in international waters.
So were you closest to Greece?
We were closest to Greece when we got intercepted, yeah.
And so by that time, how many boats were with you and how many people?
So there were 63 boats when we got intercepted, 1,000 participants, 22 of us got intercepted, so they couldn't take us all. But the reason that they intercepted us at that point was because they wouldn't have been able to handle that many boats going Turkey to Gaza. We would have broken the siege.
Oh, I see. So they realised that you were actually going to become quite a force to be reckoned with, and so they decided to take you out before you rendezvoused. It must have been keeping a very close eye on you.
Oh, they were definitely keeping a very close tab on us, yeah. They definitely wouldn't have been able to handle us. But what I think also they were thinking is that they would have sort of broken our spirits. You know, if they didn't take all of us, then the people who were left on their boats, I think they thought they would be too scared to sail on. But we continued and everybody sailed on.
How do you cope living day by day on the boat? And was the weather nice? You might have a storm.
Yeah, the weather was not always nice, for sure. Obviously, we've got like a team of people who are keeping on top of that. So if there was really severe storms or anything like that coming in, really extreme weather, then we would duck into a port and things like that. It's a very well planned out mission. It's not just a bunch of people jumping on a boat.
But how do you live day to day on the boat? Do you have your own berth or whatever? Where were you sleeping? And you know, all the basic things like you've got to have a bit of breakfast, you've got to have something to eat, haven't you?
You do, yeah. So on the first boat I was on, it was all just chickpeas. Literally, it was all vegan food. But the first boat I was on was very much, we were doing 6 hours on, 6 hours off shifts. So when you took somebody off their shift, they would jump up and you would just get in the bed that they were sleeping in. So definitely didn't have our own beds or anything like that. The second boat that I was on was a bit bigger and had a bigger crew. And I did have my own bed, I guess. Ish, you can call, yeah, it. Well, yeah, I mean, there were people sort of had to walk over where I was sleeping to get to the bit at the front of the boat.
Sounds a bit medieval. Yeah.
I mean, we do what we do to, for humanity, I guess.
Well, so was it all chickpeas all the way?
I mean, the food was amazing. We were taking it in turns to cook and stuff, but yeah, it was all chickpeas, beans, lentils, rice, that kind of stuff.
Okay, so what about your fellow crew members? So whereabouts were they from?
All over the world. There was, on my boat, there were, on both the boats I was on, actually, we didn't have anybody of the same nationality. Wow. So, yeah, it was incredible being around that many people from totally different backgrounds, totally different nationalities, but all just with one purpose.
Sounds like the United Nations.
I wouldn't go that far. But yeah.
It wasn't totally united. So did you actually have duties to do on the boat, which were sort of, like sailor-style duties?
Yeah. So there's obviously, I was a general participant, but there were captains, there were crew, there was first mate. I did end up getting involved and I learned lots of cool things as well along the way. I did say I wanted an adventure and I definitely got one. I now know some like sailing knots and things like that, and I know how to bring up the sails and things.
Oh, right. So you weren't sailing, really? I mean, surely you had an engine, motors, that sort of thing. That's a little bit ancient, sailing around.
No, we were definitely sailing. Whenever there was enough wind, we were sailing. All the boats did have motors, of course, yeah. But whenever we had the opportunity, we'd bring the sails up. And honestly, just being able to turn the engine off was just peace.
It's lovely. I know actually I do a bit of gliding sometimes, and being up in the air with no great big piston engines zooming away in front of you is lovely. What about, I don't know, because we have from Fairford been sending these B-52 B-1 bombers and things over to bomb Iran, and if you're sailing along the Mediterranean, some of those might have been going over your head.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting you say that. That was a protest I went on with my mum when I, like, years and years ago, was at Fairford.
Iraq War, probably 2003,
Yeah, many moons ago. I think I was about 15, maybe. But there was all sorts of things going over us, and we were obviously on constant lookout, looking up, because we're on drone watch and things, so there's always somebody on drone watch. So, we did see all sorts of things flying through the sky.
So when you're right out in the middle of the Mediterranean, you're still getting drones flying out to find you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So the night before interception, there was a high drone activity. We're doing all the right protocol and we're all trained on what we do when we spot a drone. On the night of the interception, there was like well over 20 drones spotted before we actually got intercepted.
And can you hear them too, or do you just spot them? Are they quite high up?
When they get close enough, you can definitely hear them. And that's when you know that something's up, because when they're a bit higher, you think they're observational drones, so they're just doing their rounds, essentially, and observing. When they got a bit lower, we knew something was up.
Can you shoot at them?
No, we're a non-violent humanitarian mission, Tony. Okay. We're not carrying.
Well, there's nobody in the drone. It's only an inanimate object. Actually, maybe it might have been made by Elbit, who knows, and it might be quite a nice thing to bring it into the sea.
I imagine they're definitely owned by Elbit, but no, there's no weapons. We even had to get rid of our knives before interception so that the IOF can't slant what our mission is and what we're trying to do, so we don't want anything that can be even perceived as a weapon.
Okay, well, this is amazing, really, that such a thing is. So what about the people you were supposed to be meeting up with? Have they left Turkey now and heading to Gaza? Have they been intercepted? What's happening with the other half of your flotilla?
So the people who weren't intercepted, they were moored up, like anchored up off the coast of Greece. They weren't allowed to enter. So if they wanted to go onto mainland, then they had to get a dinghy across because the Greek authorities wouldn't allow them to dock at port. They then set off and they joined up with Turkey in Marmaris, and they all set sail together yesterday.
Right, so they're heading over there now, right now. You know what, it would be quite nice, wouldn't it, if a nation was sympathetic, like maybe the Spanish, who seem to be quite sympathetic against the American assault on Iran anyway. Maybe the Yemenis to send a warship to escort you.
I mean, that would be lovely, yeah.
It wouldn't be very non-violent, though, would it?
I mean, an escort from a different country, that doesn't impact what we are doing. We didn't have that luxury.
So, were there countries that supported what you were doing, do you think?
So Turkey are saying all the right things at the moment. I mean, I was essentially rescued by Turkey in the end, which is a bit of a crazy story to tell and crazy stance, because I know that they haven't necessarily aligned with my beliefs and my views in the past, but I know that they're probably as anti-Israel, so
as any country's allowed to be. So you're off Crete. How far away from Crete are you when you were intercepted?
I honestly don't know exactly. But obviously it's over 12 nautical miles, I think, to be in international waters. Right. So we were definitely over that because we were still in international waters. We were then taken onto a speedboat by the IOF.
When did you first spot them? They were on the sea heading towards you in a sort of torpedo boat or something? Or what kind of ship did they have?
So they were in, when obviously we got over the drone sightings and we knew that something was up, then speedboats were spotted, and I wasn't the first boat to be intercepted. So other boats started getting intercepted. When that was happening, honestly, we thought it must be the Greek Coast Guard, because we were, before they actually started intercepting people, we thought it must be the Greek Coast Guard because...
Yeah, you're so far away from Israel.
Exactly, and you can plan and plan and plan, and...
800 miles away still.
Yeah, it's insane. This is the thing. So, we're all trained and we're all trained with what to expect, and as far as capabilities allow. But yeah, nobody planned for interception that far away. So I still had loads of things that were planned in terms of, connections that I was making with people in Gaza and sort of videos we were going to do together and things. We thought we had loads of time.
So, I mean, if just as a way of comparison, this is about the same distance as Scotland is from Iceland. It's a long, long way away, like you wouldn't want to sort of row that distance or whatever. But it's a terrifically amazing distance. So one by one, what was happening? Were the boats being boarded by the Israelis? And roughly how many of their ships did they have?
So I think we spotted around 5 speedboats. And we had earlier on, before it got dark, we had spotted essentially a warship out at sea, which we weren't 100% sure what it was. We couldn't identify it, until we were intercepted and started heading towards it, we sort of clocked what it was, and it was a prison ship specially designed for us, basically.
So how did they take you? Well, first of all, how did they arrest you, and then how did they take you off the boat?
So they came onto our boat, guns in our faces, saying they will, they didn't, other people they did fire at, non-lethal rounds, but they didn't fire on our boat, but they threatened us, if you do anything we will shoot. They then took us one by one to the front of the boat.
So let's just remind everybody, what you've got here is rice for people who are being blockaded and starved in a concentration camp.
Exactly that. And we're in international waters, and they're way out of their jurisdiction, and it was piracy. It was nothing short of piracy.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then they boarded the boat at gunpoint, took us off one by one to search us. Then, you know, I'm cutting a long story very short, then took us onto a speedboat and took us off to this prison ship.
Right, so what was that like? How long are you there?
So, I mean, time is really hard to keep on track of when you're on there. They, like, as soon as it started getting dark, they put floodlights on us and strobe lights and all sorts of things for psychological torture. But once I've got out, I was told we were on there for 40 hours, so it would have been 2 nights that we were on there for. But they did all sorts of things. I mean, I was beaten, but nowhere near. I've got passport privilege. I've got my, you know, my skin color privilege. There were people who got beaten way worse than I did. There were people who got taken into solitary confinement. There wasn't enough route. So you'd go in and there was, just containers, like shipping containers, with a little space in the middle with a few portaloos. But there wasn't enough space inside all of the containers for everybody to sleep. So some people had to sleep outside, and they would wait for people to fall asleep and then flood the floor with water. So everything they would do, you know, sleep deprivation is a known form of torture.
Yeah,
everything they did was sort of psychological warfare, essentially.
Yeah, the idea was now we've got them in custody, we can punish them.
Yeah.
For what they've been doing. So you're in there for a couple of nights. Strobe lights, you say?
Yeah. So they'd have like these really intensely bright floodlights, just again trying to stop people from sleeping. But then every now and then these strobe lights would all go off.
So did you manage to get any sleep for those 40 hours at all?
I didn't sleep, but the main reason I didn't sleep was because they took my clothes off of me. So it was absolutely freezing. You know, you're in the middle of the Med at night. It was absolutely freezing, so I spent my nights pacing, basically, to try and keep warm.
Wow. So they took all of your clothes off you?
No. I wasn't. So luckily, I had these little shorts on.
You just got a pair of boxers or briefs or whatever still.
And yeah, I had shorts on. And I did have a T-shirt at first, but that later got, when one of the times they were beating me, that got ripped off of me. So yeah, by the time I got out, I was just in shorts.
So did they bother to come up with a reason why they were beating you, or and whereabouts and how did they beat you?
So I'd been out at sea for a while then. I had a bigger beard. So they were, when I first got to Turkey, they checked me over and they thought my jaw was probably broken at first, because they were punching, you know, in the hair, where you've got hair, in the beard, in the back and in the stomach, sort of places that, you know, they're trained in this,
aren't
they?
They've
been torturing Palestinians for decades.
Fist punches from the soldiers?
Fist punches, yeah, definitely. Kicks. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think I was hit with any weapons, but I definitely witnessed other people being hit with weapons. The guy in front of me, when we were sort of dragged out to the Greek Coast Guard boat, afterwards, which I can come to that in a second.
Okay,
but
yeah.
when we were dragged out there, the guy in front of me got shot basically point blank by a flashbang. And when we got out and I went to check up on him, it had gone through his trousers, and he had this horrible burn wound, like oozy thing on his leg. So they're called non-lethal rounds, but they're designed to be used totally differently to that. You're meant to shoot the rubber bullets at the ground to disperse a crowd. They were shooting people. Zach, who's another UK candidate, he's Green Party candidate, but he's another UK participant. He was shot in the leg 3 times by a rubber bullet. They weren't using them how you're supposed to use them.
Not at all, no. But then they were using weapons against people. So yeah, so take us back to the prison ship. You're there for a couple of days, not really able to sleep, very cold. What happens then?
On the second day that we were in there, they had taken, like, Saif Abu Kashek, they had taken him away, like, separated from the group, and six in total of our comrades had been sort of kept in isolation. So we started saying, look, we won't conform with what you want us to do until we've seen our comrades and we know they're safe. We also were saying that we just want water. They were giving us water, but with a bare minimum, like, it wasn't enough to go around, which, again, I think is another way that they were trying to break us, but little did they know, everyone was sharing every little last morsel. I was on hunger strike at this point. And when we said we won't comply, you know, all that meant is when they'd come in, they'd slam you down on the ground, they'd arm up behind your back and your head down. You'd sort of walk where they wanted you to go. But after that, and we said we won't, you know, conform with your demands unless you meet ours, we would just go dead weight and make them carry us everywhere. So then essentially they need four people for every person. So that was when the violence really escalated and they thought they were going to break us in that way. But yeah, I'm sure you know that Saif and Tiago were not released with us. So we didn't know where we were going this whole time, that we thought they were going to be taking us to occupied Palestine. We were sort of trying to work out from the angle that the ship was driving and stuff. So then at one point we thought, oh, they must be taking us to Cyprus. But yeah, essentially, and then they were saying, no, look, all of your comrades are safe, they're fine, you just need to come with us, like thinking that we would just go with them. So obviously we didn't, and we were saying we want to see our comrades before we go anywhere. So then we were dragged out, and I was dragged out to this bit outside of the prison, but still within the ship. They then put a life jacket on me, and sort of pushed me off towards this big open door. So honestly, I thought they were about to make me walk the plank, or you didn't know what, you know what I mean? There's so many
not telling you anything about what they're
doing. No, of course they're not. So then I got there, and there was a boat, like a fair drop down, with a couple of people trying to offer me their hand, which I obviously refused to take their hand. And I sort of got down on the boat because I knew that was what they wanted me to do. At which point, and then one of them was saying, what are you doing? We're rescuing you. So I looked at him, looked down, and I saw that he had Greek Coast Guard written. And for about 10 minutes, I genuinely thought that they were rescuing us. I thought it was a rescue mission, but we later found out that they were in on it, and they knew that everything that was going on, and that it was pre-planned with the Greeks, basically.
Right, organised with the Greeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got onto the Greek ship at that point?
Yeah, so then we got onto a Greek Coast Guard.
Was it a large ship or small? Or was it enough accommodation for everybody on there? I suppose they were.
No, they did. I think it was 4 trips.
Remember, you've got 1,000 people almost, haven't you?
And no, because they hadn't intercepted everybody. No. So there was 180 of us who got intercepted. So right. 180
so
of us
put in
prison.
A couple of hundred.
Yeah. But they had to do 4 trips in the boat. I mean, it appeared tiny after being on that huge ship. But yeah. It was bigger than any of the boats.
So they're ferrying you to Greece from there?
So then they took us to Crete.
Right.
They took. I mean, we had no idea where we were. We didn't know what was going on.
And you'd just been in Crete, hadn't you?
We were on our way to Crete.
Ah, you were going towards Crete.
We were on Sicily,
right, okay.
Sicily to Crete. Yeah.
So they took you handily to where you were planning to go anyway, but by rather an annoying route.
I mean, yeah, with our passports confiscated.
Tortured on the way.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. We at this point, we still didn't know. So we kind of thought that there was a point where I was like, oh my God, Europe, you know, we've been away for so long and Europe's come round and, you know, we've changed public opinion. And yeah, there was about 10 minutes where I was sort of celebrating in my head. I thought, thought the tides might have shifted until we hit land and realised there were a load of armed police waiting for us, weren't allowing us to do anything, essentially, wouldn't give us our passport back. So, yeah, you know, the cogs start turning and you start realising that it's not quite the rescue mission that they've sold.
No, the Greeks are complicit with it all, really. So, okay, yeah. So once you arrive back on shore...
So then arrived back on shore, I was on the first boat. I got dragged out on, so I was on the first boat. So we had a fair amount of time waiting. So we were on shore trying to, you know, cheer our comrades when they came round to lift morale, boost morale and all that. Then by the time everybody was back, we quickly realised that Saif and Tiago were not back. We refused to go anywhere. We were trying to get on... back on the boat. We were pleading with the Coast Guard on all that, you know, they had Greek police there, they had all sorts of different authorities there, pleading with all of them, saying, look, we've just been kidnapped, they've still got two of our comrades, you need to go and get them, you know, it's your duty to go and get them. And every single answer was, look, there's processes, you don't understand, you're just a person, which was infuriating. I just stopped myself swearing there.
Yes, I noticed. Yeah. We all noticed. Yes, okay. So, and so were you actually in detention once you arrived in Greece?
Well, no, still this whole time, they kept telling us they just wanted to take us to the airport. You know, they'll take us anywhere we wanted to go. So we were saying, you know, give us our passports back then. They were
you can't without a passport, can you?
They were essentially holding our passports ransom because they wanted us to do what they wanted us to do. And what they wanted us to do was make no noise, basically, and just be flown straight out of there. But without Safe and Tiago, none of us were willing to do that. So
what, 180 of you all together on that one?
Yeah, for sure. We ended up, so then they took us on three buses. They forced us to get on these three buses and took us away. We had an assembly before they managed to actually force us on there. We had an assembly to say, you know, this might actually be the best option. If they're taking us to the airport, we can at least then get access to a phone. We can ask people if we can borrow a phone. We can start, you know, reporting this and let people know what's happened. None of us, there wasn't a single phone between us. There was, you know, we had nothing. I'm still just in no t-shirt at this point. Luckily, somebody did lend me, Katie, her name is another UK delegate, gave me her jumper because she had other clothes. So I ended up in this tiny little pink jumper. It would have been comical if it wasn't so insane. And then they took us on these bus rides, essentially, and parked up. We knew we were near the airport because planes were coming in quite low, but parked up essentially down a lane, and it was all really bizarre, and they tried to keep us there for ages.
They're trying to keep you out of the spotlight, aren't they?
That's exactly what they were doing, yeah, until we eventually worked out what they were doing. So we sort of overpowered them and got off of the bus, and started marching towards the airport, at which point there were all of these riot police further up on the road. So well, we all just put flowers behind our ears and linked arms to be like, that, you know, do what you've got to do. We're not stopping. But on that little bit, their local comrades had joined us. And so they had phones and things. So once the police realized that they were being documented, they were being recorded, they did end up moving out of the way and let us pass. Because I guess they don't want that.
They don't want the film, do they?
No,
they don't want that. And those people will be sharing it straight round social media in Greece and onto the telly round the world, possibly even, if the police decide that they're going to run into you there. So, yeah, well, it sounds interesting that the Greek authorities are very, very careful about making sure that no one can record what you're doing and that it's not getting through to the news media, actually. Maybe the Greek news media might be quite sympathetic to you.
I mean,
If
they were given the chance, yeah. I'm not too caught up on the Greek media, but if it's anything like ours, I'm going to go with a no.
Because there's been very little. I mean, there's been a bit in the local press here about your trip, but not, what about nationally? Very little, actually, about the fact that Brits were involved in this.
Yeah, very little. I mean, BBC Points West did cover a little story about it. I mean, I didn't, when I first got back and I read the story, they actually interviewed my parents. And when I first got back and I read the story, I didn't like how it was still, you know, giving Israel a voice and all of that. But they have later changed it, so it's a bit more truth-telling.
Right.
But yeah, that's still only Points West. It's still only local.
So how did you get back then? Did you get to the airport eventually? Did you manage to get some money from your comrades, or how did you do that?
So we got to the airport. I mean, the UK embassy was there waiting for us, but they sent three representatives, essentially, who were waving the butcher's apron, which, is that meant to bring you joy? It didn't to me. Waving the Union Jack. So I did go over and I was speaking to them. I still didn't have my passport at this point. All they offered us was to use their phone, basically. You can use our phone to phone home. So I had already decided at that point that I wanted to continue. So I didn't care if I had my passport or not. I knew where our boats were located and I wanted to go down there. But some comrades really wanted to go home. So we were, you know, trying to discuss with the UK embassy, who, that's their job, right, is to look after people in another country. They did absolutely nothing. They'd literally, so yeah, one of us was saying, I want to go home now. So I was saying, look, how can you get him home? What can you do? And they're like, well, he can borrow my phone. I was like, well, how is that going to help him get home? They're like, well, he can get money. But how can he get money? How can they transfer him money? Because we've literally had everything stolen from us by pirates. Like, what are you going to do about this? And they were essentially saying, we've been told that's all we can do is offer you the use of our phone.
So the idea is you phone people in the UK, get them to transfer money to buy an air ticket. That's what the embassy are offering.
Yeah, but transfer how? Like we've got.
But you can't travel without a passport.
Can't travel without a passport. So our passports were still being. It wasn't the UK embassy who had our passport yet, but.
The Greeks had them, did they?
The Greeks still had our passport. Yeah, just all of them in a big box, which obviously you're always taught from a child. You know, you don't go anywhere without your passport. But yeah, they kept hold of our passports again at ransom, essentially thinking that would stop us and we would just do everything that they told us to do.
Okay, so how did you manage to get your passport back?
We were told that we were going to be deported. So I was sort of staying back by that point.
No, you didn't want to be deported, did you? You were trying to find your boat again, get back to your boat.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't really care about my passport in that moment at all. So then we were told that the Turkish delegation and the Turkish government had sent a plane to pick up their delegation, and they had plenty of space and we could all jump on there, and they had boats obviously in Turkey, which we were going to meet eventually. So a few of us thought that was the right decision, opted for that, and they then got our passports back.
Right, so the Turkish government got your passports back that the British government couldn't.
Yeah. They were saying the right things. They were sort of going, yeah, look, we're in the queue to get your passports back. And, I mean, a queue to get our passports back. They were just sort of stood around a table talking to people. It was all a bit bizarre.
They're being a little bit overly friendly and complicit and compliant with the Israelis at that point. Okay, so you went to Turkey. You flew to Turkey, did you?
I flew to Istanbul, yeah. I got flown directly into a press conference, which was, again...
Did you have any trousers at this point, or, you know, any sort of socks or shoes, or...?
By this point, I had a Turkish Airlines blanket wrapped around and sort of rolled down. The only way to describe it is a boob tube. Like, do you know what I mean? It was, like, rolled down like that, and a kefir, which I did get given as soon as I arrived. They gave me this kefir, actually. And that wrapped over like a shawl. I looked like a really crazy old woman, basically. And it was, yeah.
With a beard.
With a beard, yeah. My beard was much bigger then as well, yeah.
So in Istanbul, what happened then?
So then in Istanbul, so we did the, obviously the press conference, and then we were taken immediately to hospital, and all of us had a welfare check, a physical and a mental welfare check, which is still more than I've had coming back to the UK. They also had a whole team of lawyers there to take witness statements from all of us, so we had to like recount everything that we could remember and that had happened, and then they took us to a hotel, and I got to have a hot shower for the first time in a really long time, because obviously there's none of that on the boats either. So yeah, genuinely I can't really fault the Turkish government in that moment. They really looked out for us.
So how long were you in the hotel for then?
So in a hotel for two nights while we were sort of talking about the next steps, and we had to, you know, talk about who wanted to continue, who didn't. So they prioritized the people who immediately wanted to go home. They knew they wanted to go home. I had said, I do a lot of stuff in media back in the UK. So I basically said, I will go wherever I'm most useful. I'm very up for continuing. But if you decide that I'm more useful at home, then that is fine as well. Eventually, they, due to the amount of spaces on boats, they prioritised captains and crew, and I'm not one of them. So they flew me home as well.
Okay, wow, at last. Did they pay for your ticket to come home? You have to pay for that, yeah, yourself?
No. I didn't pay a penny. Turkish Airlines flew me home.
Amazing. I'm impressed with the Turks, actually. They seem to be taking this reasonably seriously, don't they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean... Honestly, for all of my experience in that moment, I can't fault them.
No, amazing. Well, I mean, yes, Istanbul is one of those places, isn't it? It's been there. Constantinople, it's been there for centuries doing its stuff. So that's where you sort of started to realise that you were a human being again, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not the first hot shower, but after the second, I did have two immediately when I got to the hotel, yeah. And then another one when I woke up. Yeah, maybe the third hot shower, I started to feel a bit more like myself.
Would you do it again?
Tomorrow. Do it in an instant.
Really?
Yeah, if it could bring more attention to what the people of Palestine are suffering through, give a voice to them, and if we had any shot at breaking the siege, I'd do it again tomorrow.
Now, you talked about the butcher's apron. The British do deserve a lot of criticism for what's happened over the decades there with the creation of the State of Israel. What are your thoughts about, genuinely today? Because, I mean, obviously these are previous generations that set this whole thing up.
We're as complicit as we were then. I even struggle to use the word complicit because it's us. We're part of the decision making. It's not even, and I did for years, I just thought, Starmer's a bit of a wet wipe and he's just, doesn't have a backbone. But we're still giving money. Look, what was it, like 200 million or something recently? We're still, we are part of the fabrication. We're part of the blood of Israel. It's just insane how deep it goes. And we're fully owned by Zionists. It's scary. It is scary.
Maybe the Americans too. There's this thing they talk about the Anglo-Zionist Empire, which is this sort of almost like a shadow, and they don't like to admit that they're even there, that they're, you can see what's happening from behind the scenes. Anyway, it's an amazing story, Ben. And so now you're trying to get your feet get back together here, I imagine. What about other Brits? How did they get on?
So we've still got 13 Brits who are out there. There were a few intercepted with me and spent time in prison with me. Six of us went to Istanbul together. A few people did decide to go home, but the majority of us wanted to continue. And a couple of them who were crew have continued now, so are currently sailing.
These two activists, they're apparently just been deported by the Israelis. Any idea why the Israelis decided to hang on to these two individual Spanish-Swedish citizen of Palestinian origin, Saif Abusheshek?
Abu Keshek,
and the Brazilian Thiago Avila. Apparently they were among the people who were taken from your flotilla, but they were kept by the Israeli, were they actually taken to Israel? Looks like
they were, kept on the prison ship hostage, taken just like the more than 9,000 Palestinian hostages, taken to occupied Palestine, where they were continued to torture them. They did get worse treatment than all of us. The IOF did announce that if it's your first time, they'll be more lenient on you. If it's your second time, Thiago has, he's done this several times before. He's sort of a huge, I don't want to say he's the leader because he's not at all, but you know what I mean? It's not like that, but he's definitely the face of it. He's had a lot of experience. He's also really good with words. He brings people along. So they obviously don't like him for that. And Saif he's also been involved in the movement for a really long time. But also he's Palestinian. So of course they don't like him. He's actually got a Palestinian ID, which means they could treat him exactly as they do the Palestinians.
Well, we're going to be talking in a minute about some of the ways that Palestinians have been treated in the most utterly disgusting fashion, which has been out and about this week. I think it was in an article about it in the New York Times. The Israeli government have even threatened to sue the New York Times, saying, well, this isn't true. Well, we know that this sort of torture does go on in Israeli prisons all the time. I mean, we've got an example sitting here right now.
Yeah, genuinely. I mean, what we went through was absolutely nothing compared to what our brothers and sisters in Palestine have to endure and have endured for more than 8 decades.
And can I also ask you, as a sort of way of trying to draw a line under this in a way, is do you see any solution to this?
I see one solution: free Palestine.
How?
By public, like our government, like money talks, essentially. I do genuinely believe that. In my lifetime, we will see a free Palestine. I have to believe that because otherwise we might as well all give up now, right? So yeah, I do believe that, and I do think through education, you know, constant talking, there's, our media's done a really good job about spinning this to their favour, to make it look like, you know, Israel is the poor little victim who they just want a little bit of land for them to live
well,
on.
Well, hang on, they haven't really. I mean, it's very difficult to spin the idea of people bringing humanitarian aid to Gaza. Everyone knows that that's the right thing to do. It's what national governments all over the world, particularly superpowers, people like China should be doing this. Why can't the Chinese Navy do this sort of thing? Why can't the Russian Navy do this sort of thing? Why can't the Royal Navy do this sort of thing? It's what is it? This is what we pay our taxes for, to actually uphold human rights. But they don't. They don't. They're not doing it at all, are they?
No, I mean, they hit the nail on the head. They can do it. All of them can do it, but they aren't doing it.
Necessary for the triumph of evil is good men do nothing. And it seems to me that many, many governments around the world are saying, well, it's not our problem, shrugging their shoulders. And in that sort of situation, the Israelis are actually getting more powerful by the minute.
Yeah, they are. But like you've just said, public opinion is definitely changing. Everybody knows that it is the right thing to do. And I do believe that that's how we take it down. I mean, if we keep pressuring our governments, they're going to have to listen eventually, because they don't want revolutions on their hands. They don't want a global uprising. And we get enough people on side, that's the next step. That's what's going to happen. So I do believe keep chipping away at them. I mean, it needs to happen now. It needs to happen yesterday for the Palestinians. But it is also, Palestinians are a copy and paste project. It's what we allow to happen now is just going to be used and used and used over and over again. So we all need to act. We all need to mobilize, and we can stop it. We've got the power. We are the many.
Okay, so whereabouts do you think, if listeners are interested, where can they follow what's going on with the Palestinian activism and, you know, with your attempts to get, not just you, everybody's attempts to get relief for these beleaguered people?
I mean, just from it, so our Instagram page, UK_GlobalSumud, we try to share as many Palestinians.
So Sumud?
Sumud.
Okay.
Yeah, Sumud. It means steadfastness, resilience. It's a Palestinian word. And of course, they've got a word for that because they are the most Sumud people I have ever witnessed.
Not half, yeah.
And genuinely, we all learn any kind of, everything that we've learned came from watching a live genocide on our screens and watching the steadfastness and the resilience of our Palestinian brothers and sisters.
You talk about doing media work. What do you do? And, you know, maybe that's important, because you're quite right. The London media have been pretty appalling, actually, when it comes to the genocide.
So I do media work within the movement. I don't want to go into too much detail about it. I'm not supposed to give my give the game away, but yeah, I do mainly social media, but also, you know, some press work as well.
Well, you're doing some press work today. Thank you very much, Ben. We're going to also do stay with us, because we're going to hear now a report from Double Down News this week, who have been doing, Richard Sanders has been doing an investigation exactly into the topic we've been talking about, which is the torture by the Israelis, by the Israeli government, by the far-right bloc that's now running that country, and committing genocide against the people of Gaza, with apparent impunity, unbelievably, looking at the torture that's been going on within Israeli jails of Palestinians behind closed doors.
Power plus impunity leads to abuse, and abuse unchecked almost always becomes sexual abuse. This is true throughout history, it's true throughout the world, and it's certainly been true in Israel over the last 2.5 years. And although sexual violence by the Israelis in detention centres is reported in the West, there remains one crime that is taboo for Western media: the Israelis' use of dogs to rape Palestinian inmates. I spoke to a remarkable woman. Her name is Maha Husseini. Maha has been in Gaza since day one of the genocide, and she's been displaced 8 times. She spoke to us from Gaza City. Your organisation, EuroMed Human Rights Monitor, has produced this extraordinary report, Another Genocide Behind Walls, which looks particularly at the use of sexual torture in Israeli detention centres. Can you summarise for us very briefly what that report says?
Yeah, this report is actually the outcome of work we've been doing since the beginning of the genocide. Overall, we documented at least 7 forms of sexual violence practiced against Palestinians in Israeli places of detention, including rape, cases of rape, threats of rape, forced nudity, assaults on genitals, verbal and physical harassment, and coerced exposure to rape, where the Israeli, of course, officers and soldiers actually force Palestinians to witness the rape of other inmates or other detainees. Of course, the majority of these testimonies actually belong to men other than women. And this is this does not mean that women did not were not subjected to sexual violence as much as men, but because we are speaking about a conservative society where women actually don't feel very comfortable speaking about being subjected to sexual violence. Many men described being raped several times over the course of several days.
One thing that leaps out of your report is the use of dogs to rape male detainees. There's other evidence around this now as well. How solid and widespread is the evidence for that particular crime now?
Yes, actually, this is not the first time that we documented cases of dogs abusing, or trained dogs actually abusing or raping Palestinian detainees inside Israeli jails. In this report particularly, we documented several cases. I will just read one of the shocking cases that we documented. One detainee told us that he was detained, of course, in Sdeitiman, and this is where most of the violations occur. He said that they took a group of detainees and me to the corridor between the sections and forced us to strip completely naked. The soldiers brought in several dogs. One of them urinated on me. One of the dogs then raped me, penetrated my anus in a trained manner when I was being beaten. This continued for several minutes. I felt profoundly humiliated and violated. Other, of course, men, we met, said that after they were raped by the soldiers, they also were raped by dogs in the very same day. And this is something that also confirms that this is a systematic policy, because no army trains dogs on raping humans unless this is something that is accepted by the highest rank in the authority.
These are almost unimaginably horrific accounts, aren't they, Maha? But thank you very much for joining us, and keep
thank
safe.
Thank you, Richard.
I also spoke to a former Israeli army intelligence officer who has done the work that Western journalists have not, and brought together and collated all of the evidence about the Israelis' use of dogs to rape Palestinian inmates. His name is Shael Ben Ephraim, and he spoke to us from California, where he now lives.
Really started by accident well over a year ago, when a friend of mine, childhood friend actually, was stationed at the Sdeitiman base. And at that time, I was a fairly passionate Zionist, supporter of Israel. And he told me, listen, there's things going on in the Sdeitiman prison that you will absolutely not believe. They're so awful. And so I looked into it, and he put me in touch with two guards who had worked there. And they told me about all the torture that had occurred in Sdeitiman, but also some things that hadn't appeared in the media, like the fact that they were killing inmates and leaving them around the others in order to serve as a warning to them and that sort of thing. And I published it on X, and it got a pretty big response. And that played a very large role in my moving away from Zionism. I kept in touch with one of the two guards. I was introduced to another by the guard that I had talked to. I had seen the reports that dogs had been used to sexually assault inmates in Sdeitiman. So I just asked them about it. And to my, surprise, horror, they both confirmed it. One said that he'd seen dogs being used, and the other said that he'd heard talk about dogs being used. From my experience, when inmates in Israeli prisons testify to something, it is true. And it almost always is confirmed by the fact after Zionists and Israel supporters deny it and say that it's just hearsay. It's almost always supported by the fact. Believe the victims, especially when there's several testimonies.
That's a report from Double Down News with Richard Sanders speaking to various people about some rather horrific reports from Palestine. Still joined by Ben here in the studio, who's just come back from the flotilla. Ben, this does almost sounds impossible to believe, and maybe that's one of the reasons that these things are done, because there were people don't want to, journalists even don't want to go there, as well as people, they don't want to believe that this thing even can go on in this modern age.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think there's nothing that they can do anymore that would surprise me, and then they come out of something like this, and it just shows how subhuman and just appalling they are. And it's not something that I'm going to go into detail with because it isn't my story to tell, but even from 180 hostages that, you know, I was a part of, we already have at least 6 counts of sexual assault from that. So it's something that they use in their torture methods. It's something they use to assert control. They're just appalling people.
Isn't there one little bit of hope, though? And that is that we've got a former Israeli intelligence officer there who's just said, I've had enough.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's happening more and more. I mean, suicide rate is through the roof in occupied Palestine. So I do. I mean, the way that I'm looking at it now is, if you go through the IOF and you still think that Israel should exist, then there's kind of no saving you. But I'm a humanitarian, and I've always been like, but everybody's worth saving, man. You know, I was raised, you know, a bit of a hippie, but that just some of the stuff. There's no coming back from some of the stuff that goes on and that they get up to. But there are more and more people who are waking up to it, even within Israel or occupied Palestine.
Yeah, it's this darker side of human nature, which, I mean, I think many of my grandparents' generation, even my parents' generation, thought that they'd been banished from the face of the earth with the Second World War. But it seems to be still smouldering away. I'm joined on the line now by the former Labour MP, Chris Williamson. Chris, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. How are you?
All right. Thanks, Chris. I know you do a regular programme on the Iranian English language state media, which none of the London press in this country seem to know exists in English, which still broadcasts very fascinating stuff that you do on there. Can you just maybe start but on a slightly different topic and tell us what you make of the potential demise now, it seems, of the Prime Minister Starmer?
Yeah, I just want to say that, though. It's the Press TV hosts our output, as it were, but it's not actually for them. I mean, they just happen to host it in that sense. So they put it on their platform. So we actually we're an independent media company working.
So you're editorially independent. Yes, good.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. But of course, we were forced out of our studio that we were using that's owned by this independent company because of threats from the Home Office to, I think, abuse the National Security Act. But anyway, that's another story. As for Starmer's demise, yeah, I mean, look, he's a dead man walking, isn't he? I don't think he's going to last probably till the end of the year. I mean, and he's certainly not going to lead the Labour Party into the next election. In some ways, it'd be a good thing if he did, really, because I think it would be in the national interest for the Labour Party to go completely out of existence to enable us to create an alternative vehicle, because it's been completely taken over now by what Tony Benn used to describe as the cuckoos, the new Labour cuckoos. And the soul of the Labour Party has been expelled, and it no longer serves the interests of working class people in this country. And in truth be told, Tony, the Labour Party, Reform, Conservatives, Liberal Democrats, there isn't a great deal of difference between any of them. And some people might be surprised to hear me say that there's not much difference between Labour and Reform. But if you actually look at their economic agenda, they're both neoliberals to the core. If you look at their foreign policy agenda, they're very much enthralled to Israel. They're very much committed to imperialism. So really, there isn't really a choice, frankly, for the British people now. And that's why it's crucial, I think, that we do build an alternative. I think the Greens are beginning to offer some alternative. Obviously, I'm involved with the Workers' Party. We're still very much a small acorn. Hopefully, we'll grow, but we'll have to wait and see. But democracy is in a parlous state in this country. And that, frankly, thanks to the right wing of the Labour Party, who destroyed, and the Zionist lobby, of course, as well, who destroyed the Corbyn project and gave us Keir Starmer in his stead.
Yeah, so, okay, so what's your thoughts about people like Burnham? Really, you don't think there'll be a change of direction with him? So who's do you have any favourites in terms of who could take over the Labour Party?
No, I want the Labour Party to go out of business. And look, I mean, I know Andy Burnham. He was a personable guy. I mean, I liked Andy, as an individual. But, I mean, at the end of the day, there's not a great deal of difference. I mean, he kind of puts a human face on it. I mean, George Galloway describes as Keir Starmer as having the charisma of a plank of wood. And that's true. Andy's a different kettle of fish. And I think, there'll be a few more crumbs on the table with Andy, but at the end of the day, Andy is, again, he's a new Labourite, he's a neoliberal, he's somebody who introduced the kind of private sector into the National Health Service. He's a supporter of the Zionist project, a member, or certainly a supporter, I believe, of Labour Friends of Israel. So there is not a huge difference. Yes, I think that, we might get a few more crumbs on the table, but in terms of fundamentally, Andy, very much supports that kind of new Labour agenda, which has been absolutely disastrous for this country. It's allowed our industries to be offshored to low-wage economies. It's enabled our public services to be turned into a cash cow for the private sector. And, it's just not good enough, frankly. I mean, look, I grew up at a time when, working-class people could aspire to earn their own home, could go to university free of charge, and we knew that we were going to have a better standard of living, a better quality of life than our parents. That is no longer the case. Young people now cannot look forward to buying their own home. If they go to university, they're saddled with massive debts which actually are accruing interest, which have been, the loan book has been privatised now, and their debts are getting bigger as each year goes by. I mean, it's just an absolute scandal. And for the Labour Party to be crowing about the fact that Britain is now, once again, the fifth biggest economy, it slipped back to the sixth biggest economy, how they can be crowing about that when they left 15 million people languishing in poverty, when, precarious employment is now endemic throughout the land, when our public services are still, a cash cow for the private sector, our utilities, like the water industry, ripping people off, pumping raw sewage into our rivers, seas and lakes. And it's an absolute show defeat, pardon the pun, given that we're talking about raw sewage going into the rivers and lakes and seas. And this is just, it's just not good enough. I know some people are looking to reform, thinking that they might offer some alternative. Yes, I mean, they kick the establishment, but they're part of the establishment and they will not actually make life better for people. But I think, unfortunately, a lot of people maybe going to have to go through that harsh lesson in order for us to maybe create something, for a phoenix to rise from the ashes.
Well, look, this week we've had Diane Abbott saying what everyone should be thinking, very little reporting of it, and she's been the former Labour MP. She is actually still managing, our old colleague of yours, she still is a Labour MP, saying, Chris, that what is the point of being an MP when the bond markets can spook the government into doing, it seems, whatever they want? And if they start to stray into certain policies, whether it be to do with foreign policy, but more importantly, maybe domestic policy to do with nationalisation, this sort of thing, that the bond markets can have a veto, and they will say, right, well, anybody that starts talking about this sort of thing, we're going to just boot them out. The bond markets are.
Well, that tells you everything you need to know, really, about whose interest the Labour Party is serving. Truth be told, look, who cares about the bond markets? In reality, the bond markets rely on the government, not the other way around. We don't need the bond market. The bond market does not actually provision the government with the resources to spend on government expenditure, on public services.
Well, hang on, don't they determine? But the government is borrowing money in bonds to spend,
borrowing.
Surely.
It's actually, But it isn't borrowing, Tony. It's selling bonds. It's actually creating a safe haven, a savings, a guaranteed savings account for the super rich, for institutions like banks and insurance companies, and you know, and some foreign investors as well. No, it's not necessary. And I mean, frankly, what the government could do, it has the power to do this, is to say to the bond market, we ain't going to sell any bonds, pal. Sorry, go away. And they need the government. They need these bonds. Because, look, if you've got, say, £1 billion that you want to you know, put somewhere as a safe haven, if you leave it in a bank, I mean, the best that you're going to get, I think, is £85,000 of your savings will be secured if things go up. With if you buy government bonds, then you're guaranteed. It's an absolutely blue chip, rock solid, guaranteed return on your money, and that's basically why they need the bond market. But you know, people call it borrowing. I wish they wouldn't call it borrowing. It is, the government's not borrowing; it's selling bonds. We don't, and they don't have to sell them. They need the government rather than the other way around, because the government issues the currency. It creates the currency. So it does need the bond markets. And all this talk about bond vigilantes is just absolute scaremongering. And the tragedy is that this propaganda is insidious. Everybody's talking about it, aren't they? On the media, all the journalists, all the reports. And regrettably, a lot of people on the left also fall into the trap of using that terminology and talking about taxpayers' money and all this. It's an absolute figment of imagination. It's propaganda, and the left in particular needs to get away from that. And one of the things I've been pleased with Zach Polanski is he seems to be the only leader that understands or has some understanding of how the monetary system works, and he's pushed back a bit on that. I'd like to see him push back a lot harder on that, but we do need to learn about how the monetary system works in this country and not fall into this trap, because all they're doing is basically spinning a yarn about a, you know, basically a good society is unaffordable.
Okay, look,
and
it's Tony Benn used to say, let's put
if
you...
we can find the money to kill people, we can find the money to help people.
Yes, it would be nice, wouldn't it? So, you know, one does wonder if the Labour Party or any other party couldn't just think to itself, well, maybe we should cut ties with Israel. Maybe we should tear up any secret agreements we've got with Israel. And maybe we should start actually creating and spending money here in the UK. But I wonder, look... Chris, can you just explain in a nutshell what you would do if you were Rachel Reeves? Because there was a big thing back in the Corbyn era and when Starmer took over, of elbowing John McDonnell out, who had these ideas about quantitative easing for the people. In other words, giving people more money basically just to spend to get the economy going. And we're seeing at the moment the hospitality industry collapsing, many small businesses collapsing, because they're just, people just do not have the money to spend and to keep the economy going anymore. So in a nutshell, what would you do if you were in Rachel Reeves's shoes and able to do what you wanted?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, indeed. I mean, and actually, John, just to go back to John McDonnell, I mean, frankly, John was constrained by neoliberal orthodoxy as well. He had these ridiculous fiscal credibility rules, and I won't bore you with the detail on that, but, you know, John was problematic, actually, and it wasn't really John that was talking about people's quantitative easing. That was in Jeremy's first leadership bid, and when he was being advised on the economy by Richard Murphy. But regrettably, when Jeremy won the leadership, Richard's services were disposed of. But what I would do if I was Rachel Reeves, I would have a big fiscal stimulus. I would, for example, halve the fuel duty on petrol and diesel, because, you know, a lot of people have been forced into self-employment. A lot of, you know, the white van man, so-called, and, you know, people who need their vehicles for their jobs. I'm now finding, you know, with this ridiculous war, which has been facilitated, let's remember, by Sir Keir Starmer allowing the Yanks to use British bases, and they're seeing that the cost of filling your tank, I mean, it's going through the roof. It's great. So I would do that. I'd be investing in our public services, and I would be nationalising the public utilities and kicking the privateers out of all public services. Now, of course, you can't do that overnight. But that would be the direction of travel that I would be announcing. But what you could do overnight is start actually doing something that will stimulate economic growth, genuine, worthwhile economic growth, not this kind of talk, oh, well, you know, the economy is going to grow by 0.6%. But who's benefiting from that? It ain't working class people. It ain't ordinary people in the street. It's actually, you know, the super rich and the big corporations, these spivs and so on that are benefiting from that. So we need a complete reset, it seems to me. And, you know, we could easily do that. They could easily do that and actually make a huge difference. And it would be incredibly popular as well. But it comes back to the point you were making earlier. You know, whose interest, and, you know, when you talk about Diana, whose interests are they serving? They're not serving the interests of the people that elect them. They're serving the interests of these faceless characters, you know, in the kind of global corporate sector. And obviously, I mean, let's be honest, they, you know, the push from pillar to post by the Israel lobby as well. So, yes, they should certainly be severing any ties with Israel and actually, you know, being a government for the people. And we should be actually saying, you know, let's actually use the, you know, the budget that the, you know, the government sets, you know, to balance the economy, not use the economy to balance the budget, which is where we're at the moment, you know. And there's a lot of power that this government, because we issue the currency, we have fifth biggest economy, as I say, in the world. We're outside the European Union, so we're not constrained now by state aid rules and all the rest of it. The government has enormous flexibility to start building a good society, to give people a good, you know, a good life. I mean, the sort of, listen, I'd be content, frankly, you know, with going back to the sort of system we had in place when I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s, you know, when, you know, the post-war consensus was reducing inequality every year and was enabling, you know, people, as I think I was saying earlier, working class people, to have a good life and to know that they were guaranteed a better standard of living, a better quality of life than their parents. And we thought we were on that trajectory forever. But of course, it didn't happen. Thatcher came to power, influenced by the likes of Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. The following year, Ronald Reagan came to power, and there was this unholy alliance, Axis of Evil, you might want to say, really, who actually brought in this whole kind of neoliberal orthodoxy and saw industries, you know, in Britain, in the United States, being offshored to low wages. I mean, people talk about, you know, the Rust Belt in the United States. I mean, this was like you know, the workshop of the United States. All those jobs just disappeared. Not through new technology, we took some of them, but the vast majority were just shipped out to other countries where they could make more profit.
Let's come back up to the present. This week there is a King's speech in a rather bizarre situation where no one really knows if this government is going to be able to continue to do what is said in the King's speech. So he was, I think, left with a bit of egg on his face, Charlie. But one thing he did mention in there was the government bringing in new laws to stop anti-Semitism. He didn't talk about Islamophobia or anything else, just anti-Semitism. It does seem as if this King is possibly one of the most, I mean, he's supposed to be apolitical, but he's definitely taken a side when it comes to Palestine, it seems.
It does seem that way. But of course, I mean, he's not, you know, in control of his own destiny in terms of the King's speech. I mean, he's just reading the speech which is given to him by the government. This whole nonsense about, you know, tackling anti-Semitism. There's no real anti-Semitism in this country, in spite of the fact that a large proportion, I mean, a huge majority, in fact, of the very small Jewish community in Britain actually support Israel. But in spite of that, there is very little anti-Semitism. And I know they make, you know, a great deal about the ambulances that were set on fire and this stabbing incident by somebody who was a mentally ill man, let's remember, who stabbed a Muslim man first. And, you know, they hype all this up and they, you know, they create this sort of climate of fear. But the truth be told, I mean, there is no real anti-Semitism. There is no discrimination against Jewish people in this country. Jewish people don't suffer racism. In fact, they're in a very privileged position, actually. I mean, you know, the Jewish community is doing very, very well in the United Kingdom. But of course, they talk about this so-called new anti-Semitism. And the new anti-Semitism is this nonsense about being opposed to Israel, being opposed to Zionism, you know, this whole ridiculous IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism, which has, I think, about 11 clauses, seven of which mention criticism of Israel as an example of anti-Semitism. The Oxford Dictionary definition of anti-Semitism is perfectly adequate, and that basically is saying that, you know, discrimination and hatred of Jews because they're Jews. That's what anti-Semitism is, not being opposed to genocide, for God's sake.
Well, there's a bit of a problem with the Met Chief Constable, Mark Rowley. Tomorrow we've got rallies both by the pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian factions, effectively. We've got the Tommy Robinson people coming to London to march. There have been calls to ban the Palestinian equivalent to the Nakba march in London. What do you make of this? Because Rowley has said actually he thinks that there should be special extra money to create a kind of a pro-Zionist police force in London. It seems that he's really weighing in as a policeman into political decisions.
I agree, and I frankly think he is unsuitable for that position. But I wonder, and indeed Lowkey was making this point in a Double Down news video, has Sir Mark Rowley been made an offer he couldn't refuse by the Zionists? I mean, we saw what happened to the chief constable in the West Midlands when he very sensibly, actually, stopped the Maccabi Tel Aviv football hooligans from coming to Birmingham for a match, was it with Aston Villa? I can't remember now. But he was then absolutely pilloried, questions in the House. He was, you know, hauled before a select committee, I believe, and basically lost his position in the end. Now, whether Rowley, you know, was threatened, who knows, you know. But he was previously been very, very highly criticised by the Zionist lobby. And indeed, he's even criticised now. I mean, the thing about, you know, the Zionist lobby and the Zionist sort of ideology, they don't know when to say yes for an answer. And they have this sort of, expansionist kind of ideology where, you know, they always want more. You know, you give them an inch and they take a mile. But yeah, I mean, it's clearly unfit for purpose in my view. But the problem is, of course, whoever they replace him with, if he isn't replaced, he probably won't step down. But if he did do, the new incumbent would be subject to the same pressure from the Zionist lobby. And, you know, the problem is the Zionist lobby is given cover by the political class in this country. And, they've given diplomatic and political cover to Israel whilst it's been committing a genocide. And, I guess people, you know, at the end of the day, you know, careerists, aren't they? People get to go into a particular occupation, so they don't want to lose their job. And, you know, it's for a quiet life. They just kind of go along with it, I suspect. That's probably what motivates people. Some will be ideologically motivated, I guess. But I know from my experience as a member of parliament that virtually all of them, at the end of the day, the main thing that they prioritise above anything else, above any ideology or political positioning, was their position in the House of Commons. You know, they quite like the nice life and the big pension that they'll enjoy when they eventually step down.
Well, they've got this potential clash anyway in London tomorrow between the Tommy Robinson Brigade and the Nakba marchers tomorrow. Chris, what do you make of the ability or otherwise of? I mean, isn't this really a kind of home front for what's been going on over in Gaza?
Well, it is. And, you know, we're seeing more and more authoritarian positions being taken by the government. We're seeing, you know, a sort of a double standard policing, you know, not just by the Met, but, you know, it's increasingly people who speak out against genocide, let's be clear about it, you know, are being silenced or actually losing their careers or being suspended. You know, highly professional people, but, you know, doctors are losing their jobs or being suspended, you know, academics, lawyers, you know, these people are targeted because obviously they're influential people in society, particularly doctors, because they, you know, they are trusted by the vast majority of the people. And so, you know, you get doctors speaking out against Zionism. You know, it's obviously very problematic for the Zionist lobby for Israel, the Zionist entity, and they do everything they can to silence that. I mean, and, you know, we saw the government, didn't we? I think you just alluded to it. So Mark Rowley talking about extra money for a Zionist police force. They've earmarked, I think it's an extra £25 million. There is already, let's be clear about this, effectively a kind of paramilitary Zionist police service, which is operating in London at the moment. I mean, obviously these ambulances as well, there's a kind of a separate kind of service for the Jewish community, health provision as well. I mean, it's just it's kind of astonishing, you know. And at the same time as four ambulances, which apparently were on the last legs, that were burnt out a day or two after that, ambulances with people in them were being bombarded. I think it was in Lebanon, it may have been in Palestine, or maybe both. But no word of criticism from all these commentators and politicians who were jumping on the bandwagon and claiming this, you know, terrible increase in anti-Semitism.
Well, that's right. There was this guy near Downing Street, Iranian guy who was stabbed. It wasn't even reported. It wasn't reported at all until he'd actually appeared in court, and it was reported just in the Evening Standard and nowhere else. So it seems. I wonder. I mean, it seems to be. I'm going to ask this to Ben as well, who's still with us in the studio here. Chris, is it possible for the Israelis to win both over in the Middle East and here in the UK? In other words, to beat down their opposition. Just, it seems to me, they're trying to do it just using the media, the London media, and trying to bend people's minds.
It's not working, and they're not winning. They've lost public opinion in this country. They've lost worldwide public opinion, and in spite of all the authoritarian positions that have been put in place by the government, you know, the way the police have been behaving and so on, increasingly more and more people are stepping up to the plate and speaking out, and indeed going further and taking, you know, direct action. I mean, the, you know, Palestine action that has been proscribed and, you know, direct action against arms manufacturers that are making weapons to kill Palestinians, increasingly people are willing to, you know, to take action against these companies in spite of the repressive measures which they are being subjected to. So actually what they're doing, I mean, they've acted as a recruiting sergeant for groups like Palestine Action and, you know, for the wider pro-Palestinian movement. And so hostility, I think, to Israel has never been as high as it is now. And frankly, I don't believe they can recover from that. And I think Israel's days are numbered now. I really do.
I couldn't agree more.
Let me say one thing. I'm reminded a bit of Emperor Diocletian back in the Roman Empire, who had this thing about Christians. He really hated Christians, and so he did everything he possibly could to burn them, torture them, etc. And what happened was, actually, they increased. The numbers of Christians started massively increasing. When people saw, why is he doing this to these people? That was maybe something similar, Ben, might be happening behind the scenes with the Palestinians and Palestine's cause.
Well, I was just going to add that, like, even with all the money they've got, with all the media backing them and everything, they are losing rapidly public opinion. So I don't think they can win. I think it's their end is imminent. And we've just got to keep going. It's the final push.
So, Chris Williamson, former Labour MP, George, can I just ask you, what's happening with George? George Galloway seems to have fled the country. He put himself in exile.
Yes, George is in exile at the moment. He was, as you may know, held at the airport when he returned from a foreign trip a few months back now, back end of last year, as was his wife. And his wife was held for even longer under terrorism legislation. It's absolutely appalling. I mean, this is a guy, you know, five or six times elected parliamentarian, a leader of albeit small, but, you know, leader of a political party in Britain. You know, very big figure on the national and the international stage. I mean, I think, you know, George, you know, thought he wouldn't be subject to this sort of treatment, but he was, and he was held for 4 hours. His wife, Gayatri, she was held for even longer. Absolutely appalling.
But is he planning to come back? Because he's got a party to lead.
Well, he has, absolutely. And he's obviously doing his best to lead the party from afar, as it were. He's working with his lawyers to look at getting some sort of guarantee that, you know, he's not going to be subjected to any kind of legal action if and when he does return. Obviously, he wants to return. This is his home country, you know, and he wants to be.
Maybe he could run his party sort of remotely. Who knows? But anyway, look, Chris Williamson and Ben Trowell will be back after the break. Thanks very much, both of you, for joining us.
No worries. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. No worries.
Thank you.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap. A time to kill, a time.
Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be, whisper. sometimes wonder if I'll ever get the chance just to sit with my children in a holiday jam. I like seeing pity in your cold gray hand. Would you give a second thought? Would you ever give a damn? I doubt it. Stand on my bed. Stand down, Margaret, stand down, please stand down, Margaret.
That was ABC, The Look of Love. And just before that, we had a rather extended, I wasn't expecting that, long, long version of Stand Down, Margaret, which was Came out in 1983. That was only 3 years into her premiership. There was that. And I always remember in my mum's Mini driving down Whitehall, blasting it out in 1980 when she was forced out. But then, of course, you know, as so often happens, right now is happening again in politics. Somebody gets replaced who's even worse than the one you thought you couldn't get any worse than before. And before that, we had the Beatles. That was in 1970 with Let It Be, and Turn was the very start from The Seekers in 1966. So welcome back to not the BCFM politics show, no, it's the Bristol politics show, Tony, these days, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So in our second part, Martin, it was a bit of a, I don't want to really give you the chance to say something about what was going on with the flotilla there. I mean, it was pretty horrific, wasn't it?
Yeah, but obviously it's better to have a first-hand account from somebody who's been there rather than me commenting on what he's saying. It was obviously, you know, first-hand, what's his mouth view of what went on, isn't it?
It strikes me that the way that the Israelis are now starting to behave is more and more, I mean, they talk about concentration camp as Gaza. It's more and more fueled by racism and hatred than it is actually. They're dehumanizing, just as the Nazis did, dehumanizing people.
They are, and they've also, unlike the Nazis, got nuclear weapons, which makes it very difficult to deal with them.
But are you sure the Nazis, doesn't mean that, are you sure right, the Nazis okay, never yes, had nuclear
all right, well, let's not go down that wormhole. I'm just okay. Pointing out how this is the problem of Israel is not just a problem for the Palestinians. It's a problem for all the people in the Middle East who are under the Israeli cosh, but it's also a problem for humanity. If they provoke a world war, we could all die in it. They're going to get us all killed. It's not just Palestinian children who are under threat here. People listening to this podcast are also under threat.
So let's just look at the China talks that Trump's been doing this week. What do you make of those? I think I said it earlier flippantly, but it's almost as if he's had a bit of a ceasefire with Iran because they're mates with China and he wanted to have a nice visit.
Well, I mean, there's some speculation that the Chinese just wouldn't let him go. But that's not really their style. They did let him go, but if you notice, Xi Jinping did not meet him at the airport. A lowly person was sent to meet him. You know, the Chinese are very good at, you know, the diplomatic snubs and, you know, what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. When Annalena Baerbock went there from Germany, the German foreign minister, they made her queue up in customs. She had to queue up with everybody else at customs. But so Trump got a red carpet and he got somebody to meet him, but he then was taken to meet Xi Jinping, but she didn't come to the airport.
Could you wonder if Trump is thinking to himself, hey, this guy Xi holds all the cards?
Well, that's what everybody is saying, because it's true. The Americans, or the US deep state, as represented by Trump, have made an enormous amount of blunders. I mean, if you, all the stuff I'm reading, Mearsheimer, all of the military analysis that I'm reading from US military is this, you know, we're defeated here. This is the most serious military defeat of the US ever. And they don't know what to do about it.
Okay, so what about whether do you think the Trump's Iran war is going to restart? Is he too embarrassed to try and start it?
Well,
again?
It's still going on. I mean, these ceasefires are...
Well, the Israelis are breaking the ceasefire.
Well, that's right. I was an aid worker in Bosnia and Yugoslavia during the war there.
We had a Hezbollah commander killed during the ceasefire.
Well, that's right. But there were various so-called ceasefires in Yugoslavia. They came and went.
So is he just going to carry on bombing away?
Well, the problem for the US is if they retreat, then they've got to give up being global hegemon.
Have you seen that the Chinese tankers have been going through the Straits of Hormuz?
That's right. Chinese have seen this coming a mile off, and they've prepared their economy ready to deal with the consequences. Unlike, you know, Britain, for example, where we've made no plans whatsoever.
Are these Chinese tankers sailing past there basically daring the Americans to shoot at them?
Basically, yes. And of course, the Americans really haven't got the bottle to do that, because then the Chinese, they see the Chinese are in a position, you know, to do all sorts. I mean, they're basically playing cat and mouse with Trump. You know, we could actually put, you know, they've got monopoly on rare earths, for example. And the military-industrial complex in the West, including in Britain at Filton, all depends upon these rare earths from China. Bit of a strategic weakness, don't you think? And at any time, they can just cut off the rare earth supply, and the West cannot make advanced weapons at all.
But what about people here in Bristol who I chat to are saying, well, actually, this war by Trump against the Iranians, supposedly blocking the Straits of Hormuz, that's really a war on Britain.
Well, the whole war in Ukraine...
An economic war.
The whole war in the Ukraine has been a war on the EU by the Americans. That's why they blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Most people still don't. It just doesn't enter their consciousness.
Are Europeans ever going to realise this and start pushing back against the Americans?
Well, the elites are far too in bed with the Americans to even contemplate.
Well, through NATO and things like
that.
Well,
they're sorry. You can imagine people like Merck's, and they've come up through the system where the idea of going against the Americans is unthinkable. But of course, what we really need is politicians who could go. I mean, Schroeder, for example, who used to be the Chancellor of Germany, SPD Chancellor, the Russians were suggesting that he could be a mediator on the Ukraine crisis. And immediately the German government slapped that down. No, he's too close to the Russians, blah, blah, blah. But in another universe, Schroeder could have been leading Germany, and Germany would be basically working with the Russians. And if the Americans don't like that, we'll say go back on the other side of the Atlantic. These are our neighbours. We're working well together. And of course, the assassination of Herrhausen in the 90s, that was the Americans who assassinated Herrhausen, because he was the go-between Helmut Kohl and Gorbachev. And they were cooking up a very sensible plan to marketize the Soviet economy. But the Americans didn't like it at all, because it wasn't about them, and they killed Herrhausen, supposedly by the Red Brigade, not the Red Brigade, the Red Army faction, but it was, in fact, the Americans, because they do false flag terrorism, you know.
Judge Knapp this week was chatting with Max Blumenthal, who seems to me, I don't know if you agree, Martin, to be one of the top world English language journalists of the moment.
He's brilliant.
He seems to be right on the case
Jewish,
with so
of
much of this. And particularly here, he's asked this week, he was asked about, will Trump start bombing, exactly what I asked you, will Trump start, rejoin this anti-Iran war? Remember, of course, he's been rather embarrassed by the fact that it hasn't really succeeded. He was conned, wasn't he, by Jared Kushner, effectively, saying, oh, you know, if you attack Iran now, just a few days, that will topple the regime, blah, blah. Trump, it seems, believed it. And now it's almost
he may also be being blackmailed. Of course.
Well, maybe
that's
both.
The other thing.
Maybe
that's
both.
Going on.
Maybe both. Anyway, let's listen to Max's take.
Another article making the rounds this week was written by Robert Kagan, the husband of Victoria Nuland, the grandee of neocons, the former national security advisor to Dick Cheney. And the headline of the article is "Checkmate in Iran: Washington Can't Reverse or Control the Consequences of Losing This War." Max, I've read the article twice. It could have been written by Scott Ritter or Colonel McGregor. It's an indictment of what Trump attempted to do. Now, there are suggestions in there about future bombing, which obviously wouldn't be in McGregor or Ritter's version, but his conclusions are a slap in the face to the neocons that have influenced Trump.
Well, I think everyone watching this knows who Robert Kagan is, as you mentioned, husband of Victoria Nuland, who was Dick Cheney's chief of staff and then wound up serving under Obama and Biden as the major State Department official and architect of Project Ukraine. So Kagan's more aligned with the Democrats now in the pro-war wing. Actually, he fundraised for Hillary Clinton's 2016 run, and he is a ferociously anti-Trump figure who still obviously believes in the vision he spelled out with William Kristol, another anti-Trump ringleader from the neocon movement. His vision in the Project for a New American Century document of benevolent hegemony, his Council on Foreign Relations op-ed with Kristol back in the heady days of unipolar U.S. controlled world hegemony. And he would like to get back to that. And so he's lamenting what Donald Trump has done, correctly assessing that the U.S. has been resoundingly defeated in Iran, and that this defeat will reverberate for a generation much more than Vietnam or Afghanistan, which, as he points out, were costly but did not do lasting damage to America's overall position in the world. So he calls Iran possibly the worst defeat the U.S. has suffered militarily in its history. And he's probably correct. The difference between, you know, me and Robert Kagan is that I think that's a good thing. I think that's a great thing. Robert Kagan thinks that's a terrible thing. Why do I think it's a good thing? Do I want America to be like destroyed and turned into a, you know, a shell of its former self? No, that's not what I'm talking about. It means that America will be chastened, that it will actually, it could potentially learn a lesson. Vietnam syndrome was a good thing for America. It meant that there was a period when there was of restraint before the U.S. went into Iraq the first time, which was all about overcoming Vietnam syndrome. Who was encouraging the U.S. to go into Iraq both times? Rumsfeld, Cheney. Where were Rumsfeld and Cheney in the 70s? They were on the National Security Council of Gerald Ford. And back then, they oversaw a botched incident where the U.S. attempted to take over a ship called the Mayaguez in 1974, where U.S. sailors were taken captive, I think, by Khmer Rouge. And it was a failed operation designed to overcome Vietnam syndrome. So now Kagan is worried about an Iran war syndrome. I think Iran war syndrome could be great for America because we'll start focusing on our own problems instead of trying to do what Robert Kagan has wanted us to do, which is to topple other governments, violate international law through these violent regime change projects, and destroy entire regions in the name of spreading democracy. Robert Kagan, again, I mean, I think this is an important op-ed. I mean, he's correct that the U.S. has been defeated. He's correct about why. But what Robert Kagan signifies is the imperial elite witnessing a massive setback for their vision. And in the first year of Donald Trump's first term, Robert Kagan published his last book, which was called The Jungle Grows Back, America and Our Imperiled World. And I'll read the argument from this book. Robert Kagan, this is the thesis, elucidates the reasons why American withdrawal would be the worst possible response, based as it is on a fundamental and dangerous misreading of the world. Like a jungle that keeps growing back after being cut down, the world has always been full of dangerous actors who, left unchecked, possess the desire and ability to make things worse. So what's he talking about with the jungle? The jungle is represented by countries like Iran or Cuba or Venezuela, the so-called rogue states, the axis of evil. And the U.S. is the leader of the garden, as former EU foreign policy director Joseph Borrell infamously put it. Europe is a garden. The U.S. is a garden, and we have to keep the jungle, keep mowing the lawn in the jungle. The reality is, no, we are the jungle. That's why the Iran war happened, and it's a war that Robert Kagan had favored. That's why the Iraq war happened. That's why the U.S. destroyed Yugoslavia. And what happened when the U.S. destroyed Yugoslavia? The U.N., which had been basically taken over by U.S. power, declared that that war was not legal, but legitimate in its 1999 report. All right, so the jungle is the part of the world that has destroyed international law. That's the U.S. and Israel. What is Iran saying right now? It is saying we must have international law be respected so that, for example, our naval ship, the Dina, is not torpedoed in the Indian Ocean in international waters with over 100 sailors on an unarmed ship slaughtered. International law must be respected so that 168 schoolgirls and their teachers are not slaughtered in Minab. And the Strait of Hormuz is the choke point for Iran actually taking the, beating back the jungle. Iran is standing in the breach against the jungle, against savagery, against the barbarians who have said that they will destroy an entire civilization. So Robert Kagan's entire worldview and the thesis of his last book has been turned on its head by this war, and that's what he's upset about.
So that's Max Blumenthal there, giving us a bit of an explanation of how this Iran war and the failures of it, Martin, fitting into US history, really, as well as the potential policies for the future. But do you think Trump will learn any of these lessons, or will he just get back to thumping the table again?
Well, it's hard to predict what Trump may or may not do. I mean, obviously, he spent all night tweeting before he set off for China with all sorts of crazy stuff.
Did he? What did he say?
Well, he tweeted 40 times, I think, and he had all sorts of really, it's like, you know, you'd need a psychiatrist to sit down with him. I didn't read through all of it. I just saw some of
highlights. What sort of stuff? What sort of thing?
Oh, pictures of himself. I'm trying to think now. It was pictures of himself, doing stuff as a Superman, as it were. You know, I can't remember all the details. Anybody can check it.
I hadn't seen that, but I mean, yeah, it just sounds like he's getting a bit unhinged about.
Well, that's right.
Things.
So you've got a separate.
He can see foreign policy as some sort of cartoon book.
That's right. I mean, so you've got to separate Trump the individual from the overall strategy of U.S. imperialism. Richard Medhurst is, you know, his stuff's been circulating around because he's based in Vienna, he's a Brit based in Vienna. He's saying that all of this stuff is actually designed to try and control the world oil supply so that they can then strangle China.
During the last weeks, we haven't just seen the largest amount of attacks on Russian ships, but also on Russian refineries and export hubs, including Russia's three primary Western export hubs and several of their top refineries. As a result, around 40% of Russia's seaborne oil export capacity had been disabled. That's the most severe oil disruption in modern Russian history. While these strikes were officially claimed by Ukraine, they could have only been carried out with US backing, permission, and equipment. The United States are clearly establishing a massive global oil blockade against Russia and China. The reason the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor was precisely because the United States imposed an oil embargo on them. Russia and China are much more powerful than Japan was at the time, so I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss the possibility of this potentially turning into an actual world war if it continues to escalate. Now, Iran export around 60% of the oil they produce, and like Russia and Venezuela, they export most of it to China at a discount. Iran make up around 11% of China's seaborne crude imports. Since President Maduro was kidnapped, China has sought to replace the loss of Venezuelan crude with higher volumes of Russian and Iranian imports, making a reliable, steady supply all the more critical. As Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz, these ships shouldn't usually have any problems getting through and would in fact be prioritized as China is a strategic partner. However, the very nature of a war ensures chaos. Iran's experimental toll system, like all infrastructure, is being systematically disrupted by the US-Israeli attack, resulting in a crippling backlog. Moreover, in dealing with a pirate state, the threat level from Washington has reached irrational and unprecedented levels, as evidenced by the assassination of Khamenei and the torpedoing of the Iristina.
Death and destruction from the sky, all day long.
The US are now operating as a pirate state. They needn't even enter the Strait of Hormuz and can simply lie in wait near Diego Garcia or across the Indian Ocean to ambush commercial vessels at will. Ultimately, pricing cargo in UN achieves nothing if the cargo keeps getting sunk by an irrational actor. For the time being, this means that all three strategic suppliers of Chinese oil are either out of action, under attack, or threatened by the United States.
Well, this is a fascinating piece of work. Well done for flagging this up last week, Martin. This is Richard Medhurst is pointing out that actually what's been going on quietly behind the scenes is the Europeans mainly, maybe with some help from the Americans, have actually been doing an enormous amount of sabotage of Russian refineries and Russian tankers.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a situation where a war at sea could break, a full-on war at sea could break out at any time.
Well, I'll put a link up to the full interview for it. It's a report by Richard Medhurst there. Very important, very fascinating. What he's essentially saying is that whilst everyone's looking at Iran and worried about Iran, what's really going on is the Russians are getting more and more angry because their ties with the rest of the world are being sabotaged by the Europeans.
Well, it's not just that. There's also been drone strikes inside Russia coming from the Baltic states. And the Latvian government has just collapsed because a drone was being fired from Ukraine over Latvia into Russia. But the Russians must have got their electronic warfare, and they actually crashed it into a Latvian oil refinery. So the Latvians found themselves drawn
what?
In.
What? I haven't heard about this at all. Yeah.
Well,
so
there's
a drone. So the Russians basically what hacked into the drone?
Hacked into the drone. That's what people are speculating. Right. And then it hit a Latvian oil refinery, and it's caused a big. The government in Latvia is first the defense minister was sacked by the prime minister, but now she's been forced out. Because in actual fact, the Baltic states are now facing up to the fact that if they really do provoke the Russians, they're not really in a very strong position to fight if the Russians decide to punish them. And they might be better off to just be a bit more cautious.
Ukrainian drones aimed at Russia landed in the Baltic country. So an oil refinery, but they're not really reporting this properly. I mean, the headline is fairly clear. Is this the only problem that there is in the Baltic states?
No, there's a further complication, which is a lot of the drones that Ukrainians are now using are being assembled across Europe. There's probably some being assembled in Filton, for example. And they're saying, if you're going to do that, at some point we may decide to hit the factories where you are making these drones, which are coming into Russia and attacking our people.
Well, on the Judge Knapp this week, Scott Ritter pointed this out.
None of the leaders who today are articulating this aggressive stance have a political future. Merz is not going to win the next parliamentarian election. Macron is on his way out in 2027, could leave sooner. Keir Starmer is a joke. His party just collapsed. The polls are talking about removing him right now. And none of the military's work. The British have said, we can't buy any new equipment until 2030. We don't have anything. So forget the British military. They've always been a joke. You could fill a modern soccer stadium. You know, we're getting ready for the World Cup. One of these stadiums, we're going to host a game. You could put the entire British military inside it and still have 30,000 unsold seats. So they're a joke. Forget about the Brits. The French, they can't deploy more than 7,000 troops at once, and they don't have the airlift capacity, and they have no logistic sustainability. So they're a joke, and they can't build up because they have an economy that doesn't function. This is why their governments have collapsed repeatedly because of budgetary issues. And you're suddenly going to say that they're going to sacrifice pensions and other worker compensation to build up a military for a war that doesn't need to exist. So they're done. And then we have the Germans. They put 111 billion euro into a military replenishment fund, and they can't say what they built with it. 111 billion euro went into this replenishment fund in 2022, and they've got nothing to show for it because their military is so broken, so fundamentally broken, that it's just a money pit. And they could just pour money in. The Germans can't do anything. They mobilized this brigade going to Lithuania. Always a bad idea to have a German brigade in Lithuania going up against the Russians, but hey, I'm just a historian. What do I know?
And Scott, in the longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, he talks here about how the Russians are making very clear noises that at some point in the not-too-distant future, if you don't stop messing around with our strategic interests, we're going to hammer you.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the Russians are very patient, as are the Chinese and the Iranians. I mean, they're very, you know, they're not reckless in the way they approach things. But on the other hand, they've got a parliamentary election coming up in Russia in September. And the pressure on Putin is from people saying, well, you know, get the gloves off. Yeah, that's the pressure on him. Now, of course, Putin, in fact, is very, you know, very cautious. The general staff have been saying to him all along, well, you know, there's things we can do it. Why don't we do them? And he's saying, no, we're going to do it my way. I'll try and talk them round. But at a certain point, the sand in that hourglass will run out. And of course, at that point, the Russians are not going to say, we'll do a little tit for tat here. They will go for it. There could be a massive strike, as there was on Kiev this week, on Britain. You know, we're not going to warn you. We're just going to hit your factories in Filton. They probably won't do it in the daytime where people are there, but they'll vaporize them. And then we will be at war with Russia.
And we will know that that's where the drones are being made.
Well, they know exactly where they're coming from. Of course they do.
So will you be at this Tommy Robinson Unite the Kingdom march tomorrow, Martin?
Yes, I'm
waving your flag.
I'm going. Yeah, I'm meeting up with Tommy in the pub before we go. Before we go, yeah.
Are you?
No.
Okay. So, but it's looking, shaping up to be potentially a clash. It's not easy for the London cops to deal with.
Well, the cops
two have big marches. That's what's happening.
Well, the cops the Palestinian march side are not very happy because they'll be marched. I'm not going to go.
Weren't they told that actually they weren't the police didn't want them to march today because they thought it could be dangerous that Tommy Robinson was marching. And the fact that, if I remember from a few weeks ago, we were talking about this, that although the NACBA march had been organised with the police long before, Tommy Robinson's deliberately chosen tomorrow to do his march as a direct threat to them.
Yes. It's the politics surrounding this stink.
When I say Tommy Robinson, of course, I really mean Israel.
And Stephen Yaxley-Lennon is his
and
proper
Mossad.
Name.
Mossad.
Well, I mean, he's on the payroll. I mean, everybody knows that. Loki's covered all of this. He's on the payroll. And we are seeing a very, very sinister development here. Rowley is obviously under the thumb.
On the payroll?
On the payroll. I mean, I think, I've looked at the speakers who are going to be there. I'm not going to London because I've got other things to do tomorrow, but lots of people will, obviously. And the speakers, we've got lots of MPs speaking. Tommy Robinson hasn't got a single MP speaking. But they're going to get Trafalgar Square. Why should they have Trafalgar Square? And, of course, that's what we could, you know, if this was Belfast in 1969, we could turn up mob-handed and demand we go to Trafalgar Square, otherwise we're going to get the bombs
trying desperately to...
But we're not going to do that, obviously, that's not the way it's going
to be. It seems to me it's part of the home front, as is, you know, things like deplatforming people and making sure that individuals don't have bank accounts. There is quite a lot on the home front of this whole Palestine business, and I'm really inclined to agree with Ben, we were hearing from earlier, saying that if we do not deal with the Israelis in Gaza, this power will creep right across the world and clearly come back here. So we'll be going to be seeing a little bit of this Israeli power tomorrow in the shape of Tommy Robinson and his friends.
Yes, all waving Israeli flags to say how British patriotic they are.
Low key, and Double Down News did a super job this week, along with the previous report we had from Richard Sanders about the Israeli rape in Israeli prisons of Palestinians, which I think circulate that report on the newsletter that I send out this weekend. It's quite an interesting report, and it's all factual, documented stuff. But you mentioned Loki. He had this to say this week about Tommy Robinson and his friends.
This is the shocking story of how Israel lobbyists Tommy Robinson and the Met Police have colluded to surround pro-Palestine marches in London. Rather than defend your right to free speech, they are actively trying to destroy it on behalf of a foreign power. This is the story of how Met Police Chief Mark Rowley learned to love Israel and Tommy Robinson and hate the Palestine marches in London. 2 years ago, Suella Braverman emboldened the far right onto the streets to oppose supporters of Palestine, resulting in violence and attacks on police. 2 years and a genocide later, emboldened by a political class and ever-increasing authoritarian police, the far right is bigger than ever and takes to the streets on Nakba Day, while the Palestine protests are shackled by police and silenced by politicians. For Braverman and Tommy and many of these leaders slash so-called patriots, this isn't about uniting the kingdom to protect the realm. This is about uniting the kingdom to defend Israel.
I very strongly rebut suggestions that Israel's in breach of international law, that there's a genocide, that there's a forced starvation. Quite the contrary.
In late 2023, Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary at the time, referred to the Palestine marches in London as hate marches.
To my mind, there's only one way to describe those marches. They are hate marches.
Suella Braverman went as far as explicitly stated, Mark Rowley must go. It's important to note that Suella Braverman has family members currently serving in the Israeli military, alongside her Israeli husband, Rael Braverman. Braverman has now smoothly sidestepped into the government of tomorrow, Reform UK. Suella Braverman had a key silent ally in their bid to oust Rowley, none other than Tommy Robinson. In June 2024, Tommy Robinson held a rally specifically for the purpose of bringing down Mark Rowley.
We're about to start the march. Thousands and thousands have travelled here from across the country. We're going to go send a message to the establishment and the police. ResignMarkRowley.com. Cut the head off the snake. You've betrayed our country. You've oppressed our people. You've treated us like pieces of... We want peace and we will make it!
A pincer movement was forming. On one side, there was within the institutions of government, from figures like Braverman, the calls for Mark Rowley to resign, and then on the other side by street protesters like Tommy Robinson. Ultimately, these people were part of an Israel lobby push to achieve the objective. Either Rowley gets tough on pro-Palestine demonstrations or he stands down. That was the choice which was given. It seems he has chosen the former. At the beginning of this campaign, Mark Rowley seemed to defend himself. He called the calls for him to resign illogical and ill-informed. However, as things developed, it became clear that Rowley was the subject of strategic engagement by key elements of the Israeli security services. He gave a speech at the Israeli intelligence think tank, the Institute for National Security Studies. Leaked emails have exposed that the INSS runs counter-influence projects with the Israeli Internal Intelligence Agency, the Shin Bet, and the Israeli External Intelligence Agency, Mossad, and with the military intelligence, Aman. The current head of the INSS is none other than Tamer Heyman. He is the former chief of Israeli military intelligence, Aman. The previous leadership of the INSS is Amos Yalding, who was also formerly the chief of the military intelligence. Many of the researchers at the INSS were formerly employed by Mossad, the Shin Bet, and the Aman. And while, of course, the INSS claims that it is independent, it has received funding from the Israeli Ministry of Defense and the National Cyber Directorate in the Israeli government. In fact, the INSS goes so far as regularly submitting strategic analysis for the Israeli president. It even provides policy recommendations to key figures in the Israeli government. This institution that Mark Rowley spoke at has even piloted social media monitoring tools developed by Israeli cyber intelligence firms like Cognite to track what they call international influence campaigns. Surely those kind of campaigns would fall under the jurisdiction of someone like Mark Rowley.
So there's an investigation from Doubledown News by Loki, making it pretty clear, Martin, that this guy has been basically, Rowley's been put in a little box by the Israeli government and by their influencers here in London.
Yes, and if you think back to, if you remember what happened, Suella Braverman called for the marches to be banned. The Metropolitan Police pushed back and said, because what they argued was it was not Remembrance Sunday, it was the Saturday before Remembrance Sunday, and there was some kind of, you know, remembrance event at the Cenotaph. And so Braverman, as the, and I didn't realize that she was actually married to a Jewish guy, and that's why she's called Braverman. She said, well, you know, that we can't have these hate marches marching at the same time as people are, you know, remembering the Second World War at the Cenotaph. So they should be banned. And the police said, well, we can't just ban them. So that obviously, you know, Rowley was still showing some independence at that point. And of course, what actually happened is we had the Palestine march, which went off without any trouble whatsoever. Tommy Robinson and quite a lot of his lot turned up. They were all drinking and popping coke from their credit cards, and they stormed the police protecting the military parade around the cenotaph. And that, so the Home Secretary has encouraged a mob to attack the police, and the police are protecting the old soldiers and sailors and airmen who are around the cenotaph. Meanwhile, the Palestinian march has absolutely peacefully passed off. Now, this is very sinister. And of course, if we do end up in a war with Iran, we are in a war with Iran, as we know, but we haven't had any casualties yet. Quite soon, we might find a lot of British casualties. And I'm not talking about civilians. I'm talking about people in Akrotiri. They could be hit with a rocket from Iran, and we could have maybe 200 casualties. People will suddenly wake up. And, of course, we can't win a war with Iran. So if we start a war with Iran, we're going to lose.
Talking of cocaine, I don't know if you've seen this Tucker Carlson interview with Zelensky's PR woman that's been aired this week. I'll put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I've got a clip to play you right now. But, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. She's talking about all the evidence that she's got about his cocaine use. And more importantly, the fact that he's not really, it seems, working for Ukraine at all. He's working for outside foreign powers. It's exactly what we've been saying for years, a proxy war.
Yes, and if you look at what's going on in Latin America, Trump is still, and his acolytes are still just whacking fishermen, basically, off the coasts of Colombia and Venezuela, that with no legal basis whatsoever. And, of course, at the same time, they've let off this guy who used to be the Prime Minister of Honduras, who was sentenced to 40 years in prison in a U.S. court for cocaine trafficking. We're talking, you know, loads and loads of cocaine, not a small amount. And he was let off at the same time as these people are being killed for supposedly smuggling when they're not. And the other thing that's happened is Noboa, who's the president, I think, of Ecuador. His family are the biggest landowners in Ecuador. They're banana billionaires, and his banana boats have been used for years to smuggle cocaine. And he's been given, and the US military have sent their people into Ecuador to try and crush supposedly the cocaine cartels. But the prime minister of the country, or the president of the country, is heavily involved in cocaine trafficking. And of course, I went on a delegation, trade union delegation, to Colombia in 2005. The dogs in the street in Colombia know that the cocaine industry is run by the CIA and the Americans. It's kept illegal because that makes it profitable. If it was legal, it wouldn't be as profitable. And of course, what they do is they make a load of money out of it, and they use it to fund paramilitary death squads in Colombia, like the Autonomous Defenses de Colombia. At the same time, they use it as an excuse to intervene because they've got to put a stop to all this evil drug
dealing. The war on drugs. And also, what about the Philippines? Talking of the war on drugs, gunshots have rung out this week at the Philippine Senate because one of their MPs has been holed up. Ronald De La Rosa, police chief under ex-president Duterte, faces an international criminal court arrest warrant. So the idea is he's going to be brought to the Netherlands and face charges. But of course, Bush and Blair, you know, no, they're not going to be. So more than a dozen gunshots rang out at the Philippine Senate as police and Marines moved in an attempt to arrest a senator wanted by the International Criminal Court for alleged crimes against humanity. Journalists ran for cover as gunfire erupted on Wednesday evening, just after soldiers with rifles and protective gear went up the stairs of their Philippines parliament. It is not immediately clear who fired the shots. The senator had earlier said he was anticipating his arrest, urging people to come to the legislature to prevent him from being detained and sent to the Holland. I don't know what you make of this, Martin, but Duterte did what you would say was a rather strict clampdown on drug dealing in the Philippines, didn't he?
Yes, I mean,
the top people, by the way, they were focusing on the top dealers in the country.
Yeah, I mean, there's a legitimate concern about what he was doing there, because they were just basically executing people out of hand, as Trump is doing. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to have laws against drugs, you've got to actually force the law. You can't just shoot people on suspicion, which is basically what he's doing. But the real problem with Duterte, from the West's point of view, is he wanted to have an even-handed policy towards the Chinese, which makes perfect sense. If you're the Philippines, China is your neighbour.
81-year-old Duterte is actually in jail right now, waiting for a trial. He's 81 years old,
that's
Duterte.
Right.
So this is a clampdown on drugs in his own country, which he was elected to do.
Yes, and but leaving aside the drugs issue, the real problem they hated about him, if he'd been on side in terms of facing off with the Chinese, they wouldn't have cared. Nobody would have said anything. Don't forget, the US military are at this moment just shooting people at random and bombing people at random who are supposedly selling drugs. Is that ridiculous? You can't take a small ship from Venezuela or Colombia into the United States. It's too far away.
So, yeah, 6,000 suspected drug dealers were killed in official operations. Apparently,
yes, and of course there were questions asked about that. But if he'd not been, I wouldn't say he was pro-Chinese. What he was, he wanted the Philippines to have an independent policy. And of course, previously the Philippines kicked out U.S. bases when Marcos regime was overthrown. In the 90s, they kicked out all
but
U.S. bases.
What he's saying,
but
here
now
is,
the U.S.
Martin,
bases are back.
Let's just be clear about this. What they're both saying, these two Filipinos now facing charges, is that everybody that was killed had resisted arrest. They gave warnings to everybody, right, either get out or you're going to be either surrender and be interviewed, or because they had guns, often they decided to have a shootout and they lost.
Yes, all right. The detail of what he did...
It's quite important, though, isn't it?
It is.
I'll put a report up on it.
That's right, but I mean, it's not just... The drugs are just an excuse. The reality is, it's the policy towards China and the Spratly Islands and all the rest of it. That's what it's about, because the US is trying to surround the Chinese with hostile states so that they can then, you know, choke their development. But of course, these local states, Japan, Philippines, South Korea, they've got a vested interest in actually doing business with the Chinese, who are their nearest neighbours and are in fact doing rather well, and they could join in. I mean, the Chinese would no doubt happily invest in the Philippines to help them develop, but they're not allowed to. And of course, the Philippines has been under the thumb of the US since it was conquered in the 19th century. And they carried out massacres of the locals.
If you've seen this, Martin, but RT have done something called their Social Wellbeing Index, World Ranking, which is looking, and of course, you're not supposed to be able to see RT, but this is a slightly separate website with the RT logo, and you can see it. So they're looking at all sorts of things to do with the family, really, to do with things like fertility, to do with education, to do with whether both parents have to go to work to earn a living. Mm-hmm. And so they've done a world ranking index. Now, Russia don't do amazingly well, but would you like to hazard a guess who might be near the top and how far Britain is up the list?
Well, I would imagine that China is probably near the top.
Not really, no. Look, and it's just a bit unfair of
me. I don't know what the basis of the...
Well, it's,
of the
as I've just explained,
is.
It's about family and family values, that sort of thing. Kuwait is at the top, at the very top. Second is Ireland. And I think this is because there isn't so much pressure on people to work, that the housing costs are less in Ireland, that sort of thing. Saudi Arabia is high, Bahrain, a lot of these Gulf states are actually apparently great places to live and great places to bring up a family. Denmark and Slovakia, Belgium and Qatar as we go down. And Britain goes right the way down. Actually, it's off the bottom of the list here. I think we're around about, 40. The United States is at 48. And United Kingdom is at 53. So it's just a different way of looking, rather than just looking at GDP.
Yes, but of course, when you construct these kind of indexes, I once had to look at a World Bank report, which had not been written yet, so I got a hold of it before it had been, I got a hold of the notes that they were using, and they just invented this liberalisation index, which showed how which Eastern European countries have got most liberal economic, and that if you actually looked at the small print, The index itself, you can create an index to show anything you want, really. It's something like GDP is just money, but you can create an index of anything else you like, and you can tweak it to show what you want it to show. Yeah.
Well, you're suggesting that the Russians are just conning everybody. Yeah?
Well, listen,
they might be. But look, this is a look at how easy it is to bring up a family and how much leisure time you have.
Yes, okay, but of course, in Saudi Arabia,
of course, it's very, very difficult to bring up a family these days.
In Saudi Arabia, they're possibly only interviewing the Saudi citizens. But of course, there's loads and loads of people in Saudi Arabia. United Arab Emirates got 10 million people there.
Just not
only true. 1 million
in this report. That's
citizens.
Not true. In this report, they're looking at everybody in the country. They're not looking at one ruling class
I would suggest that the male construction workers in the Gulf who haven't got their families with them work all the hours God sends in very dangerous circumstances.
But then maybe it means that they've got enough money to run it. Maybe they've got enough money to actually have a family.
Well, they're sending their money home. That's how they're able to provide a family, but they're certainly not there with them. They don't allow them to bring their families when they come to build these stadiums and all the rest of it. I mean, I'm not saying that's wrong. I mean, it depends on the methodology behind the report, doesn't it?
Yeah, okay. It certainly looked good to me and interesting. So I'll share that with you, dear listeners. Don't believe a word I say or what Martin says. You can have a look and decide for yourself on that little RT report there. But final item for this evening is, well, it's actually an interview that I did last Sunday, but don't worry, you're not going to be hearing me. I was interviewed by Canadian Patriots Network, nothing to do with Tommy Robinson and his Patriots. That's run by Matt Errett over in Canada. And he interviewed me about my book. He'd obviously seen my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, which looks at the connections between Winston Churchill's private secretary Desmond Morton and Adolf Hitler's private secretary Martin Bormann, and the way that he was brought back to the UK right at the very end of the Second World War. I got a chance to give a sort of presentation about it. But one of the things that came out was looking at China, particularly because Trump was in China this week. I thought I'd share this bit with you, which wasn't me at all. It was actually mostly Matthew Errett talking about what it was called China Secrets, his little section. He decided to title it, which was rather nice, I think, Born in the Witch's Cauldron, which is the Bilderbergers who started their first meeting in something which was nicknamed in the Second World War the Witch's Cauldron by the Nazis, who were killing a load of Brits in the town of Arnhem in this cordon. Brits were surrounded, the 1st Airborne Division, and the Nazis called it the Witch's Cauldron. So that was the title of the piece, and I'll put a link up to that, of course, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But this is what Matt Errett had to say about China.
Tony mentioned secret societies in China having some role in having control over the government there. Mm. As a corollary to secret societies in the United States. So I just wanted to get a little more clarification about that.
Okay. We're going to be putting together an actual documentary, Cynthia and I, very, very shortly, that'll deal with a big chunk of this story. And also it'll tackle it from the standpoint of dissecting the architecture of the deep state structures, their origins and influence inside of China. Like, where are the Davos influencers, the Soros influencers, these secret society networks, which are pretty well mapped out. The thing that's noteworthy about the triads is that they had to survive the purges. They got illegalized in 1949, and they were given sanctuary in Hong Kong when the British were running it. And so Hong Kong became the base, as well as Taiwan, of the triads by and large, as well as Macau under Portuguese control. It happened again under Deng Xiaoping. He also illegalized secret society. So they were legalized and purged in two wars, 49. And then in 56, it happened again. And then in 77 or so, there was another takedown. But again, the British were always very happy to help provide as much support and sanctuary to these networks, which were then able to be used as pseudo Chinese, sort of like Chinese on the surface appearance, but not really in heart, to penetrate back into China. So if you look at like the growth of the Shanghai clique of billionaires that's sort of since the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank of Commerce days, when it was still a stronghold of the British, it was and still has remained to be a big problematic zone of traders, which also speaks to maybe why Nick Lange chose Shanghai of all places to go in China. It makes me have to just think about that. I'm not, but when you look at like all of the George Soros networks in the 70s and the 80s that were coming into China, it was through Shanghai and Hong Kong, and they even took control of the government. One of the key patrons or students that Cynthia is going to go through in her video of Zhao Ziyang, who is the Soros operative who became secretary general and tried to do the coup d'etat in 89. He had a student, a disciple, who became the governor of the Bank of China in 2015, 16, 17. He was fired from that position, but still it just shows you the immense amount of influence that this clique has. That and I think he, to this day, Cynthia was telling me that he still runs the Davos in China.
So that's Matt Eret speaking on a longer talk that I did, and all sorts of questions. It was quite good fun. It was about an hour. I was talking for about, I think, about 50 minutes about the connections between the Brits and the Nazis at the end of the war and what happened to all the loot, the connections to the Bilderberg conferences. And then there was a whole load of really, I mean, a very, I think, high-level questions, some really good, fascinating stuff. So, and I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Before I say goodbye, an ode on the topic of the Mandelsonians, which are slowly being expunged from the Labour Party, maybe. Where egos dare. Sorry, no. Where's egos dare? Here's your hat. What's your hurry? Another farce upon us forced. This man won't go, even though divorced from fact, fiction, reality. In Mandy's mire, sly, marma, see. Distraction, factions, tangled weaves. This gang of mobsters hope, deceive. PD's choice of candidates. McSweeney handed out the bait. PD is Prince of Darkness, by the way. A coup from street. See Wes stage right. Foe fisticuffs, watch wrestlers fight. Behind his stance, a seasoned grafter, streeting, greeting. Tears of laughter. Bun fights, cat fights, mob fights too. Charlie's awe, in this, 'tis true. 17 minutes of time to starve. The promised land, our streets will save. Democracy, conflicts with rules. Bankers' interests made us fools. Debt enslavement, private banks. Economies now watch them tank. Financial actors sliding scenes. On many levels, markets glean. Debt snapped up by rich men ghouls. Bureaucracy of cesspool rule. Thank you, Patricia. Martin, do you want to just round up by saying what you think of streeting? Because it does seem as if there's been a bit of hesitancy to call this leadership challenge because the powers that be, the Mandelsonian faction, aren't sure they can win it.
Well, I think credit where it's due. What Streeting has said is we're not going to have an election. He wants to be the Prime Minister, that's pretty clear. I don't think he's going to be the Prime Minister because the membership of the Labour Party, of which I'm one, we don't want it. So when it comes to our turn to ballot, we're going to vote against it. But on the other hand, he has, to his credit, said, I'm not going to try and just steal the premiership, whereas Andy Burnham has got to be, you know, I've got to deal with Andy Burnham. So he's obviously chatting behind the scenes with Burnham, and he's saying, well, once Burnham is wins the by-election, if he can win it, then we will talk about having
Will they be saying, well, you've got to do X, Y, and Z, and then we'll make sure the city doesn't collapse the economy?
Well, the problem with the city collapsing the economy is it might just collapse anyway because of what Trump's doing with Iran. The June window coming, the next month is going to be crucial because that's when the oil not coming through the Straits of Hormuz starts to affect everything everywhere. And pretty soon, that's going to pop the AI bubble. And that's going to happen whatever we do.
So why and how are the city hanging on? So surely they want to move their money now.
not wait well, till then.
But no, the reason why the stock market is at the highest it's ever been is just as it was before in 1929. The thing is, markets are not necessarily rational. The free marketeers believe that markets are rational. They're not. Bubbles are a part of what,
are we
the way markets
about
work.
Animal spirits.
Yes, animal spirits. That's what Keynes used to call it. And of course, if you
I don't believe in animal spirits.
People do
I
not
think
bet on the
I
stock
think,
market.
I think they're more like Trump, actually. And what they do is they will wait until the right point. They'll announce something, and everyone will have already bet on the it collapsing
at that
point.
What they hope to do is dump all of the debt on the pension funds. Yeah, so the big boys will take the money. And that's what, and then all of the small people who've got their money in pension funds will lose all their money. That they are plotting that, that's true. But even if they didn't do that, bubbles are inevitable part of capitalism. They've always have been. The South Sea bubble, the tulip bubble, the AI bubble. This is the biggest bubble in history. And of course, the technology of bubbles, where you used to have little bubbles, we've now got massive, massive bubbles. But they all burst in the end.
They do. Anyway, have a good choir practice next week, Martin. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to Martin Summers there. Also, of course, our guests that we heard from earlier. That is to say, Joe Banks, Ben Trowell, and Chris Williamson, as well as, of course, our sound engineer, Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. tonight to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. I am Shadowband at X on X at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5, apparently without Martin. Maybe we'll have a live link with Martin and hear some of his dulcet tones. Who knows? God bless. Think of others before yourself, and don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
The chains are tightening. The key is turning. The gavel is coming down.
Your fate
is short.
Baby on trial. The straight is the lock. Iran is the key. Hear the tick tock. Baby in chains. The world is the court. Iran is the gavel. Your fate is short.
360 million facing starvation because of one man's reckless escalation. Fertilizer prices up, the fields are dry, and America's missiles, watch them fly.
Baby on trial. The straight is the lock. Iran is the key. Hear the tick-tock, baby in chains. The world is the court. Iran is the gavel. Your fate is sure.
Washington Post wrote the truth today. 25% of missiles gone away. Pacific stockpiles empty and cold.
China's watching. The story unfolds.
You needed those rockets for Taiwan shore. Now they're in Iran and you want more? Atlantic Magazine said it clear as glass. Iran decides the future now.
First class.
Baby on trial, the straight is the lock. Iran is the key. Hear the tick tock. Baby in chains. The world is the court. Iran is the gavel. Your fate is sure.
$50 billion spent on the sand.
Who's holding the cards?
Iran's right hand. And pick JD Vance to take the fall.
But Iran holds the pen.
That says it all.
The strait is closed for you and your friend.
This is the moment.
This is the end.
You thought you could bomb, you thought you could hide. But the world is watching from every side.
The chains are tightening.
The key is turning.
The gavel is falling.
The world is learning.
Baby on trial, the straight is the lock. Iran is the key. Hear the tick-tock. Baby in chains. The world is the court. Iran is the gavel. Your fate is short. Baby on trial, the straight is the lock. Iran is the key. Hear the tick-tock. Baby in chains. The world is the court. Iran is the gavel. Your fate is short. So baby,
the straight is still closed.
The key is still here.
The gavel is coming down.
Your fate is short. Baby on trial. Baby on trial.
Bibi on trial. Bibi on trial.
drop. A deeper love. For Phyllis and Cole at number 63. Lunch on Kiss this Friday.
Need a little pickup, you'll find a little teacup will always hit the spot. Oh, the soldiers may be fighting in the trenches or a battleship at sea, but there isn't any war when the clock strikes four.
Knock it!
Everything stops for tea.